on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Starts tomorrow at 12:30.
On 92 to 95 FM, on BBC Sounds and on digital radio. This is BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of November. This is Today with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
The headlines. We can't always start the news with someone saying it's the best day of our lives, but those are the sound of Scottish fans celebrating after the men's football team dramatically qualified, what goals, for the World Cup for the first time since 1998. We'll be following that story and that reaction and that glory and joy throughout the programme. And over in America, an apparent U-turn from President Trump to release the files, as Congress has voted in favour of forcing the Justice Department to release those documents linked to the late paedophile and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
Also in today's programme, the victims of one of the UK's longest miscarriages of justice speaks to the BBC for the first time.
I can't forgive them for what they've done to me, because it's going to be there for the rest of my life.
We'll speak to the lawyer who stood by Peter Sullivan for 20 years after he was wrongly convicted of murder. The latest findings on ultra-processed food from Dr. Chris Van Tulleken. Are they really as bad as some scientists claim? And did early humans kiss Neanderthals? More on that eye-catching research after 8 o'clock. The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Scotland's men have qualified for the Football World Cup for the first time since 1998 with a dramatic 4-2 win over Denmark in injury time at Hampden Park in Glasgow. Steve Clarke's side needed a win to ensure a place in the tournament, but they twice lost the lead before making a decisive breakthrough to turn around their World Cup fortunes. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss was watching the match at Hampden Park.
An unforgettable finish to a quite unforgettable night as Scotland ended their long World Cup wait in barely believable fashion. Needing to beat Denmark to qualify, their hopes seemed over with a score 2-2 going into injury time.
It's fallen to Tierney!
But Kieran Tierney fired them ahead before, from the halfway line, Kenny McLean sealed their qualification in sensational style.
He's knocked it from the halfway line!
It's certainly been some roller coaster for Scotland, but they rose to the occasion at the perfect time. And after 28 years of heartache, finally, gloriously, the World Cup beckons.
Wales are still in contention to qualify for the tournament after thrashing North Macedonia in Cardiff. Their 7-1 win ensures they'll play their World Cup semi-final playoff at home. Both chambers of Congress have voted to force the Justice Department to publish files from the investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. After making a U-turn on the issue, President Trump now says he'll sign the bill into law as soon as he gets it. He had previously described the campaign to release files as a Democrat-led hoax. From Washington, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
For months, Donald Trump has resisted calls to release the Epstein files, even as many of his own supporters have been clamouring for him to make the information public. Now the bill has been passed by Congress, he will have to decide shortly whether or not to sign it into law. He's said he is prepared to do so, but if he really wanted to, he could have published the files without congressional approval. If he signs the legislation, the Justice Department will have 30 days to release the files, which campaigners believe will reveal the names of rich and powerful men who participated in the abuse of many of Epstein's victims.
Figures released in an hour's time will reveal last month's rate of inflation. The rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, stood at 3.8% in September, and many economists think it will fall slightly. The Chilean authorities say that five foreign tourists, including a British national, have died in one of the country's most famous national parks when they got caught in a fierce snowstorm. They became lost while hiking in Torres del Paine in the Chilean part of Patagonia. A man freed after being jailed for 38 years in one of the UK's longest miscarriages of justice has told the BBC he was bullied into falsely confessing to the murder of a 21-year-old woman on Merseyside. Peter Sullivan was speaking in his first interview since his release 6 months ago. He was cleared after new DNA evidence proved he wasn't the killer. Phil McCann has the details. In his report, Mr. Sullivan's voice has been disguised.
Peter Sullivan wasn't allowed access to a solicitor when he confessed in an unrecorded interview to sexually attacking and murdering Diane Sindall in Birkenhead in 1986. Now he's told the BBC he was beaten up in police custody, and officers threatened to link him to a series of rapes he hadn't committed if he didn't confess. Merseyside Police says it has no details of those allegations. Mr. Sullivan says he now wants an explanation and an apology.
I can't carry on with my life if I can't get an answer of them. That's all I want is an apology for the reason why they've done this to me.
The force says it regrets that there's been a grave miscarriage of justice in this case. Its investigation into the murder is ongoing.
A parliamentary aide who was targeted by a social media account suspected of being run by Chinese spies has described the incident as deeply worrying. MPs, peers and parliamentary staff have been warned by MI5 that two profiles on the networking site LinkedIn were used to try to collect information for Beijing. The Chinese embassy in London has dismissed the claims. More details from our political correspondent Georgia Roberts.
Simon Welband is a researcher for the Conservative MP Neil O'Brien, who was sanctioned by China in 2021. Mr. Welband said he discovered the message, which the BBC has seen, on his LinkedIn account from one of the profiles which the intelligence services believe are being used on behalf of the Chinese Ministry of State Security. The message, sent 3 months ago, was written in poor English, offering a job opportunity involving remote working. He never responded and reported it to Parliament's security services. Mr. Welburn said he feared more junior staff could be fooled by this sort of message and thinks espionage attempts are becoming more common around Parliament. The Chinese embassy in the UK said accusations of espionage were pure fabrication.
Scientists have traced the origins of kissing to more than 21 million years ago. The Oxford University-led team gathered evidence of animals that kiss each other on the mouth and worked out their evolutionary relationship to each other and to humans. The lead researcher, Dr. Matilda Brindle, says they found lots of evidence that chimps, orangutans, bonobos and some gorillas kiss.
We know humans, chimps and bonobos all kiss, so probably their most recent common ancestor kissed. And we think that kissing probably evolved around 21.5 million years ago in the large apes.
Dr. Matilda Brindle.
Very sweet. Lisa, thank you so much. 7 minutes past six. Let's go over to who's got the weather this morning. Let's have a look. Look, it is Simon King with the weather. Good morning, Simon.
Hello, Emma. Good morning. Yeah, got loads to get through this morning. A real mixture of rain, sleet and snow. But the snow, of course, is going to cause some problems for some of us over the next couple of days. Significant amounts accumulating. Ice, of course, just goes with that hazard as well. But for southwest England and Wales, we've got an area of rain, sleet and snow this morning. Much of that snow is falling over the higher ground of Wales, but even down to some lower levels. You may be seeing some of that this morning. Not likely to settle too much. The risk of some ice as well, of course. Now, that rain, sleet and snow is all going to move southward, clearing, and there'll be some sunshine into this afternoon. But a brisk northerly wind, that'll bring in some showers around West Wales and southwest England. Again, there could be a bit wintry over higher ground. Temperatures of 3 to 6 degrees. For the Midlands, Eastern and South East England, pretty wet start of the day. Again, some rain for most, but there is a bit of a mix of sleet and some wet snow in there as well, particularly of the higher ground of, say, the Downs. The rain is going to clear eventually. It will stay quite cloudy. There'll be the possibility of some showers coming in around the Wash and East Anglia. Temperatures are 4 to 7 Celsius. North East England, North East Scotland and Northern Scotland. Sunny spells today, but we do have quite a lot of frequent heavy snow showers coming in off the North Sea. These will be giving some significant accumulations over the higher ground. That could lead to some disruption. Temperature 0 to 4 Celsius, a bit feeling colder than that. Northwest England, southwest Scotland, a bit of rain clearing away to the south. Lots of sunshine today, chilly in the brisk wind. Temperatures 3 to 6 degrees. And for Northern Ireland, a mixture of sunny spells and wintry showers, highs of 5 or 6 Celsius.
Simon, thanks very much. At 6:09, let's have a look at this morning's papers and the headlines. We do not normally start with the back pages. I mean, sometimes we do, but this morning is a bit of an exception because all of them marking Scotland's dramatic victory over Denmark to qualify for the Men's World Cup for the first time since 1998. The Power of Scotland is the headline in the Daily Mail. The I newspaper goes with Flying Scotsman, Tartan Army off to World Cup after Hampton Thriller. But we may be slightly biased. We do think radio is the best way to tell the story. Just have a listen to our BBC Scotland colleagues, Alistair Lamont and Michael Stewart, commentating on that magical and extraordinary final goal.
Scotland just need to hold out for a few more seconds. My voice just needs to hold out for a few more seconds. As Gilman has it, he's surrounded. He pokes the ball back. Surely now Scotland will hold on to possession. It's McLean. He's looking to go for goal. From halfway line, it's Chip Smith. Oh! Glorious! Glorious! Kenny McLean from the halfway line. Scotland 4, Denmark 2. We are returning to the World Cup. What a night!
What a night. Follow that, Amel.
And welcome back to Radio 4 at 6:10 for different things. We're going to have loads more on that, of course, with Mike Williams and plenty of other guests throughout the programme. As you'd expect, photos of a jubilant Scotland squad celebrating their World Cup qualifying win appear across the front and back pages of the Scottish papers too. Wait over is the headline in The National, according to the Scottish Daily Mail. Scots are finally on top of the world. Excuse me, on top of the world. The Scotland edition of The Times says the roof nearly came off the stadium at the final whistle.
Yes, we will stick with that. We need that shot of joy this morning. The iPaper, moving across to that, has more on the warning that profiles on the networking site LinkedIn are being run by suspected Chinese spies. It says the profiles are connected to senior officials within the Home Office, the Foreign Office and NATO. After a warning from MI5 that those involved in politics are being targeted by China, a senior government figure tells The Times it's sending a clear message to Beijing that it knows what it is doing. But the Financial Times says the dispute threatens to strain further a relationship that Sir Keir Starmer has tried to improve.
Farage told me Hitler was right, is the headline in the Daily Mirror. It quotes a former classmate of Nigel Farage as saying he recalls him using racist taunts at school. The story originates in The Guardian, which says it has heard from more than a dozen people who accused the Reform UK leader of deeply offensive behaviour throughout his teenage years. One, the director Peter Ettigui, tells the paper that in an apparent reference to Jews, he would say, quote unquote, gas them, sometimes adding a long hiss to simulate the sounds of Nazi gas chambers. However, others do not recall this behaviour. In legal letters to the paper, Mr. Farage emphatically denies saying anything racist or anti-Semitic when he was a teenager. Reform UK says the allegations are, quote, entirely without foundation, describing them as cynical attempts to smear the party and mislead the public.
And a report which says the UK is underprepared for an armed attack is highlighted on the front of the Daily Telegraph. The paper quotes the Commons Defence Committee as saying the government is moving at a glacial pace in the face of renewed threats from Russia and China. The Ministry of Defence says it will set out its plans to bolster the UK's warfighting readiness later today.
Time now is 6:12. Both chambers of Congress agreed to order the US Justice Department to release its files on sex offender financier Jeffrey Epstein. The House of Representatives overwhelmingly approved the measure in a 427-1 vote, and the Senate unanimously fast-tracked it without a formal vote. The move comes just days after President Trump reversed his position and urged Congress to vote to disclose the records following public pushback from many of his supporters, including Marjorie Taylor Greene. And a short time ago, I spoke to our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley. I started by asking him what had changed overnight in this debate about Epstein.
Well, it's almost the mother of all U-turns, isn't it? The president initially having supported the idea of releasing these Epstein files while running to get elected. For the past few weeks, he's described a Democrat hoax and a distraction by the Democrats, seemingly surprised by four House Republicans essentially supporting Democrats last week to make today's vote possible broadly. So on the eve of this vote, he's asked Republicans to go ahead and to support publication. But not lost in all of this, of course, is the fact that as the President of the United States, he has full executive authority at any point he has had to sign a bit of paper that would have the same effect of going through Congress. So it is quite a convoluted way of doing this.
And it seems to have caused a fundamental rupture in the MAGA movement, the Make America Great Again movement, including the remarkable spectacle of Marjorie Taylor Greene, previously one of Trump's most loyal lieutenants, speaking out against him.
Yeah, it's interesting in so many fronts, that, isn't it? Because, you know, if you think of Marjorie Taylor Greene, if you think of President Trump, you'd probably almost visualise wearing the red hats, as they have many times, standing aside each other at those podiums. She would say, electing our favourite president, and he would support her, saying how tremendous and wonderful she was. But now they've fallen out massively. And actually, it's quite a big falling out, because even despite Marjorie Taylor Greene having supported some controversial conspiracy theories in the past that she's apologised for liking social media posts calling for the death of former President Obama and a former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Donald Trump didn't stop backing her at that point. Now, it wasn't just the question of supporting Democrats. Marjorie Taylor Greene had criticised other policies of Donald Trump, for example, his foreign policies and his tariffs. But it does definitely jump out from the Truth Social page that it was after that support last week by Marjorie Taylor Greene that he started calling her wacky and described her as a ranting lunatic.
Sean Dilley in Washington, really good to talk to you. Thanks, Sean.
It's 6:15. There are warnings that the risks surrounding Russia's so-called shadow fleet are growing. Maritime authorities are reporting a spike in such tankers sailing without a valid flag. And these vessels, which frequently sail past us here in the UK, are also suspected of undersea sabotage and illicit drone launches. Jess Parker, our Europe correspondent, has been getting up and close with this issue. And first of all, just to explain, a shadow fleet, what do we mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's not got an official definition, but it's typically understood to refer to ships, in this case, oil tankers that are used to evade Western sanctions, and in this case by Russia, after people remember a price cap was imposed following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Analysts say these ships are often got obscure ownership, obscure insurance arrangements, even use sort of deceptive tactics. So that's what a shadow fleet is generally understood to mean. And then there's this important point that we're seeing globally, but also from people I've been speaking to in the Baltic, and as you say, ships that go into the Baltic past the UK, a rise in what's known as false flagging, where a vessel's flying a national flag of a country it's not actually registered to. And this matters because it ups the ante of risk, basically, with these vessels being potentially old, potentially invalidating their own insurance. If there were an accident, I'm being told, well, who would you find that was responsible for that and therefore to pay for that if, say, for example, there was a catastrophic oil spill?
What are they doing, Jess?
So how it works is, say, a vessel might, for example, claim the national flag of a country that doesn't even have a registry, or claim a national flag of a country it's not actually registered to. So those are kind of two examples of what false flagging can look like. And I mean, look, countries that we visited, we went out with the Estonians, the Swedes, they talk about stepping up checks, showing presence, not least of all as well because of the concerns you mentioned around alleged sabotage related to shadow vessels. But there is, I think, a reluctance to intervene too heavily. Ships that aren't breaking the rules are entitled to freedom of navigation, even if they're sanctioned, to head to Russia and pick up oil. But I think there's also a fear, Emma, of retaliation if countries get too aggressive towards vessels that, of course, are making a lot of money for Russia.
And the Russian response to this?
Yeah, so we actually approached the embassy in London for Moscow, and they called the term shadow fleet discriminatory. They called it misleading, and they essentially argued that Western sanctions are what have disrupted and fragmented the overall maritime order and increased the risk. But I think a final broad thought, if I can, which is what is going on out on the Baltic, but also on the Channel, on the North Sea, the rise in these practices, it is being seen by experts as a real challenge to the global maritime order, and the rules of that that have been around for decades are really struggling to catch up with what's happening.
Jess Parker, our Europe correspondent. Thank you.
It's 18 minutes past six. We're all a bit starstruck here because Sean Farrington is here in person in the studio, and he's got a big story for British industry to lead off with.
Yes, huge developments in Scotland. Hundreds of staff have been told their jobs are at risk after ExxonMobil announced it's going to close part of its plant in Fife early next year. So ExxonMobil, America's biggest oil company, petrochemical giant, it says it's been trying to find a buyer for its Mossmorran plant for some time, but there's no longer what it calls a competitive future for the site. It's an ethylene plant, so a crucial ingredient for the manufacture of plastics, food packaging, medical equipment, car parts and plenty more as well. The plant has been a big employer in that area since it opened in 1985. There are more than 400 staff and contractors who could lose their jobs. Paul Greenwood is ExxonMobil's UK chair, joins me now. Paul, good morning. Why are you closing it?
Good morning, Sean. I appreciate the time to talk to you. Yeah, let me just pick up on what you've said. It's a very sad day. We've been operating a Fife ethylene plant for 40 years, as you described. And our thoughts are clearly with our brilliant workforce, who should feel extremely proud of everything they've achieved over those 40 years. And that 40 years is clearly producing ethylene, but it drives value, it drives economic activity, it drives jobs and growth. And therefore, to have to give up on that site now that we're facing just insurmountable challenges is a very, very sad day for us, and our thoughts are clearly with our employees. But let me answer your question directly. Why are we doing this? There are four keys to success in the ethylene business. And effectively, let me explain very quickly around what happens. So we take production from the North Sea, so gas production, and we separate out a gas called ethane. We take that down to our plant in Fife. We create ethylene from there, and that then used, as you say, to make plastics, components, other various other different things. Therefore, we need to have, key to success number one, cheap, abundant ethane. We need to be able to operate in a way that is low cost. We need to have a market that pays good prices for ethylene. And I need to have a highly skilled, highly dedicated, focused workforce to make all of that work. And at the moment, Sean, I'll be blunt, I have one of those keys to success in place, and that is a brilliant workforce.
Okay.
Two of those keys I deliberately do not have because of government policy. So take the ethane supply. You know what's happening in the North Sea. We've had windfall taxes. We've had a ban on production licenses. I need cheap sources of abundant ethane, and I do not have them because the North Sea, because of government policy, is declining rapidly, and that ethane is increasingly high price. If I come to the second part, which is I need to operate at low cost, I have to have a burden put upon me of CO2 taxes. We paid £20 million last year in CO2 taxes. That will double in the next 4 or 5 years. My international competitors do not have those costs.
So
I also have to deal with high energy costs and those kind of things. So these are deliberate government policies that are undermining us. And the fourth one clearly is the market. The market is providing a very challenging environment, which is meaning that those government policies are really hurting the site.
So, Paul, last night, the Industry Minister, Chris McDonald, told the House of Commons that the government's commitment to support UK industry was clear.
This is not a decision that either the company or the government have taken lightly, because, as honourable members know, this government has shown that it is prepared to step in and support industry when it is feasible to do so. We have stepped in to support business in the steel, shipbuilding and chemicals industries, protecting jobs and vital capability across the UK, including in Scotland. But in all cases, there was a fundamentally sound business proposition underpinning our investment. And sadly, here, this was not the case.
So, Paul, we've seen announcements as well, you know, in recent times about support for energy-intensive industries. I know you mentioned those taxes around carbon, but there have been this supercharger scheme, so subsidies for the electricity network of up to 90% from next April coming in. If it's just not feasible, why should the government be putting more money in?
So we reached out to the government back in April and had a very open and frank conversations with them. I'm pleased the time we could spend with numerous secretaries of state and ministers explaining our challenges. We wanted to just be open. Look, this is what we're facing. These are the policies that are undermining our business. The government decided at that point that they weren't going to be able to change those policies in order to make the plant economic. That was the decision we made, and we will live by that decision. What is really disappointing now, though, is that all of those policies are still in place, which means the North Sea will continue to decline. We will continue to have more imports into the UK. we will be less secure in terms of our energy supply, and global emissions will increase because these products will not be made here, but will be transported in. So we need to have a conversation with the government, which is Fife Ethylene Plant and its closure is an example of how bad policy is going to hurt jobs and undermine economic growth in the UK.
You're closing plants elsewhere, though. ExxonMobil's talked more widely about you're going to cut 1,200 jobs across the EU and Norway by the end of 2027.
Yes, we have some significant restructuring that we're doing, and I would say that the UK is not alone in having some extremely damaging policies for industry. The whole of Europe is facing that. So a lot of the challenges that we face are in Europe, and we are cutting back on jobs and cutting back on some of our activities in order to effectively move our investments where we have got better chances to produce the products that society needs at a cost that is affordable for people. That's a great shame for the UK. It's a great shame for the EU. But that's the reality that most businesses are facing.
Could ExxonMobil have done more? The reports in the Financial Times today, you know, sort of saying that ExxonMobil, there was a lack of engagement as the options were explored for saving the site, cancelled meetings set up by the Department for Business and Trade and the Scotland office, and ExxonMobil failing to provide information requested by officials.
It's been very disappointing, Sean, to see how some of this has been played out in the media. We have had numerous meetings with the government and, as I mentioned, secretaries of state, and I'll name them for you. We've met Peter Carr, we've met Douglas Alexander, we have met Ian Murray, we have met Johnny Reynolds, we've met Emma Jones. We have met lots and lots of people over months and been extremely transparent. Now, clearly, this is a very, very unfortunate situation, and people have chosen to represent that in various different ways in the press. And it has been extremely disappointing to see that. We approached the government in good faith to have an open and direct conversation around the policy changes that were impacting very detrimentally our business. And it's very disappointing to see how this has played out in the media over the past few days.
The local MP has talked about hearing that staff who've been told their jobs will be at risk still have no idea of the redundancy package they'll get. I mean, ExxonMobil, huge multi-billion-dollar global business. That shouldn't be the situation for employees.
Sean, that is not the situation. And that is another example of an extremely disappointing misrepresentation in the media. Our employees were made fully aware of the redundancy package yesterday. Our employees have been treated with care and with empathy, and we've gone to enormous lengths to make sure that everything is explained to them in terms of why we've made the steps that we are and what this means for us. And we will continue to look after our employees. That is our number one priority, the safety of our employees and their well-being.
You have a plant in Forley in Hampshire as well. Can you say that this won't go the same way, that you have confidence of backing that plant for many years to come?
We have absolute confidence in backing that plant for many years to come. But I will tell the government the challenges that we've faced at Fife are some of the same challenges we face at Forley. Increasing CO2 costs, very high energy costs, high regulation. So I would say, yes, Forley is a very, very strong asset, is a strategic asset for us. But the government needs to understand that the whole of the industrial base in the UK is at risk unless they wake up and they realise the damage that their economic policies are doing.
Paul Greenwood, ExxonMobil's UK chair, thank you very much for your time this morning. George Godber is fund manager at Polar Capital. George, just your reflections on that situation. ExxonMobil, the state of the chemicals industry in the UK, more widely across Europe, what's it really telling us?
Oh, that's truly heartbreaking. But I think you've summed it up very well. That's actually, yeah, we are turning our back on the North Sea with very high tax rate, and there is an industrial consequence. And from my point, the fact that it'll lead to higher emissions because we're still going to use these products, we're just now going to have to stick them on a boat powered by diesel, and they're probably going to be made in a plant in a country where it gets its electricity from a coal-fired power station is really heartbreaking. It's truly heartbreaking.
George, just looking more widely at where investment markets have been in the last 24 hours, we've seen stock markets down a little bit again. Cryptocurrencies taking a bit more of a tumble. Bitcoin at one point dropping below $90,000. What's occurring here?
So, first of all, take a step back. It's been a pretty good year for markets. Even our much maligned UK performance has been pretty decent. We've seen a big sort of risk-off move in markets moment, heightened selling, and especially you do see it in places like crypto, where you've seen sort of a noticeable sort of fall of like 25% in the share price. That's sort of indicative of investors getting jumpy into year-end.
And how closely will people be watching these NVIDIA results, the chip maker behind so much, you know, making those chips behind so much of the AI advancements at the moment, and seeing how that company is actually doing?
It's so difficult to get your head around the numbers of this company, especially at this early time in the morning. But yeah, the market is they've guided for $54 billion of revenue. The number to keep in your mind is that probably the analysts are expecting $57 billion of revenue just in one quarter. There'll be lots of focus on some of these sort of circular vendor financing deals that have been happening and what that means for the business and the sustainability of the AI theme, as you very well touched on yesterday with your Google interview. So just, you know, even small movements in this company are worth more than, you know, many, many, many listed businesses. You know, if it moves 5%, it's, you know, it moves more than, you know, almost every company in the world. So it's, the focus is absolutely huge because of the concentration we've seen in global markets into this space.
George, thank you. George Godbutt, fund manager at Polar Capital. Yeah, Faisal's interview with Sundar Pichai at Google at Alphabet having quite the ripple effect through the tech world and beyond yesterday and into this morning.
Sean, thank you. It's now time at 6:30 for a shot of joy in the arm. We've got Mike here with the sport and what scenes.
Well, Emma, there is only one story around this morning, isn't there? We're going to be talking about it all programme. And the great news for bleary-eyed Scotland football fans who might be just coming to this morning is no, you weren't dreaming.
It's all over! Scotland have won the group! They've won the match 4-2! They have done it! And just look at this! You have just witnessed history. Scotland are going back to the World Cup, but just look what it means to them. A moment in time, a moment to treasure, a moment that many of us thought would never be seen again. The 18th of November, 2025, at 9:48 p.m. Scotland confirmed their return to the greatest show on earth.
And that party, you can bet, in all four corners of Scotland is probably still going this morning at 6:31. Yes, for the first time since 1998, Scotland's men will play at a World Cup. And they did it on an unforgettable night at Hampden that just about had everything. Wonder goals, red cards, last-minute winners. It eventually ended 4-2 to Steve Clarke's side. So how does it feel to end those 28 years of hurt?
Feels good. I said at the start of the campaign, I felt the pressure of the nation to try to get to the World Cup. So immediately that falls off your shoulders and you feel a little bit better. But what a fantastic group of players. How determined they are to be good for their country. They showed that tonight. I couldn't be happier for that, for my players. I couldn't be happier. It's fantastic. It feels great.
Well, the match featured, arguably, three of the greatest goals in Scottish football history. Scott McTominay's acrobatic bicycle kick after just 3 minutes. Kieran Tierney's 95th-minute beauty of a curling shot from outside of the box. And then Kenny McLean's audacious 50-metre stunner from inside his own half that lobbed the Denmark keeper and made absolutely sure of the victory with what was the final kick of the match. Here is the post-match reflections from Tierney and McLean.
Oh, it's mental, man. One of the best feelings ever. Unbelievable. This group, the staff, all the fans, everyone deserves it, man. And oh, it's brilliant.
Whole place deserves it. It's been a long time, obviously. We knew we had the ability to do it, but to do it, obviously, later on feels a wee bit more special. Just, listen, it's amazing. Obviously, everybody's family up there. We've obviously spoken about it the last few days and we knew it was possible, but to go and actually achieve it, incredible, honestly, incredible.
Yeah, if you haven't seen those goals, worth saying, you can watch them right now on the BBC Sport website. They are absolutely world class. So Scotland on their way to the World Cup next summer. The next key date for them is the World Cup draw, which is happening in Washington, D.C. on the 5th of December. So just a couple of weeks until Scotland find out who they will face and where they will play at their first World Cup in 28 years. And just briefly, should say on any other morning, Wales would be the top story in the sport. What a night for them in Cardiff. They'd already qualified for the playoffs, but Craig Bellamy's side last night thrashed North Macedonia 7-1.
I spoke about to the players in a meeting just before we came here. We could really enjoy tonight. And I said to them then just at the end, I'm not a perfect person. I haven't come across anyone who is. But maybe I take a little bit of that back because I was as close as the perfect performance I've seen. That was incredible.
Yep, so Wales into the playoffs and the draw for those will take place tomorrow.
And the Ashes are starting on Friday. Mike, your cup runneth over. Mike, thank you so much. A beloved duo returns to Radio 4 next week.
Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders return to Radio 4 with a new series.
A series, you say?
You mean it's real? What is it this time?
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen, a comedy about two sisters at war.
Selena, do you even have an attention span?
Well, certainly not anymore, you know, because of the 60s.
Written by David Quantick.
Let's talk about me again. Well, I don't wish to rain on your parade, Selena, but it sounds dreadful.
Well, there we go, my mistake, moving on.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen.
Out of the way, Florence!
Starts next Monday at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Looking forward to that. It's 26 minutes to 7. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Almal Rajan and Emma Barnett. And now we have a summary of the news with Lisa Costello.
Scotland's men have qualified for the Football World Cup for the first time since 1998. They beat Denmark at Hampden Park, scoring twice in injury time to seal the 4-2 win. The captain, Andy Robertson, said the match showed his team's never-say-die attitude. Both chambers of Congress have voted to force the Justice Department to publish files from the investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. After making a U-turn on the issue, President Trump now says he'll sign the bill into law as soon as he gets it. He had previously described the campaign to release files as a Democrat-led hoax. Figures released in half an hour's time will reveal last month's rate of inflation. The rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, stood at 3.8% in September, and many economists think it will fall slightly. MPs have warned that the UK is too over-reliant on the United States for its defence and underprepared for an armed attack. The chair of the Defence Select Committee, Tan Desi, said the government must urgently prioritise homeland defence and resilience. A man freed after being jailed for 38 years in one of the UK's longest miscarriages of justice has told the BBC he was bullied by police into falsely confessing to murder. Peter Sullivan was speaking in his first interview since new DNA evidence proved that he didn't kill 21-year-old Diane Sindel on Merseyside in 1986. Merseyside police said it regretted that there had been a grave miscarriage of justice in this case and its investigation into the murder was ongoing. The number of days taken to deal with shoplifting cases has risen by more than 80% in the past decade, figures obtained by the BBC have found. Police in England and Wales recorded more than 500,000 shoplifting offences in the year to June. Retailers who've been targeted say the time it's taking to bring shoplifters to justice is unacceptable.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. 23 minutes to 7, let's turn to domestic politics, shall we? Because Westminster's reckoning with an MI5 alert issued yesterday warning parliamentarians to be alert to the risk from Chinese spies. Henry Zeffman is our chief political correspondent. Henry, morning. Where does this leave UK-China relations?
Well, it's clearly a big deal and certainly designed to be seen as a big deal when MPs, members of the House of Lords and all of their staff in the middle of the day are sent an espionage alert by MI5 warning them to watch out for Chinese activity and specifically warning of approaches on the professional networking site LinkedIn. That said, as we've dug more into the specifics of these LinkedIn approaches, some of it doesn't necessarily feel wildly sophisticated. We've spoken to one researcher for a Conservative MP who was approached on LinkedIn by one of these profiles which MI5 are warning about, in a message in broken English offering a job opportunity involving remote working. So I think there is, you know, a bit of people calibrating how much of a threat some of these messages might actually have been and whether they would have genuinely ensnared anyone. In terms of the broader relationship, look, clearly the UK has come a long way from what was known as the golden era of relations with China. It's 2015 when David Cameron took Xi Jinping to the pub near Chequers for pints, and that feels more than 11 years ago, I think, or more more than 10 years ago, I think, in terms of relationships. But this government has adopted what it would see as a more pragmatic approach to China, clear-eyed about the threat from China, but keen for more economic connections. That may well be becoming harder to maintain politically. That's not just because of what was announced yesterday, but also the weeks of controversy over the collapse of the case of the two men accused of spying for China, both of whom denied wrongdoing. And the big thing sitting on the horizon is the decision over China's plans for a new and much expanded embassy adjacent to the City of London. And that decision is due on December the 10th.
And Henry, once upon a time in ancient history in British political terms, so about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, budgets didn't really leak, did they? You sort of a few whispers in the wind, but essentially you had to wait till budget day. And we've had so much noise, stories around this morning about potential mansion tax, about sort of Rachel Reeves meeting with backbenchers, and a general impression, I think, that this has been a leakier budget and a somewhat more chaotic budget, according to many commentators, than we're used to. What do we know about why or what Rachel Reeves is up to and what she's proposing to these backbenchers?
Yeah, according to many Labour MPs, as well as just commentators, to be honest. I mean, speaking to them this week, sort of the week after the weekend before, as it were, where it became clear that the income tax rise everybody had been carefully encouraged to expect wasn't after all happening, I think there, many of them sort of felt a bit dazed and dizzied by how this has all played out. But I think it is worth stressing that we've had the politics of the preamble to the budget. We still await the politics of what's actually in it. And as per the I newspaper and a few others, Rachel Reeves has been having backbenchers into number 11 Downing Street, where she lives this week, to brief them on her upcoming plans. And some of them were left with a very clear impression that she was going to pursue, if not the wealth tax, which some on the left of the Labour Party have been calling for, more taxes on wealth, including on property. We also had yesterday, by the way, parties of the right beginning to lay out how they are going to criticise the budget. So Kemi Badenoch saying it would not be possible for the country to avoid bankruptcy without cutting the welfare bill, and Nigel Farage confirming that he wanted to keep the two-child benefit cap for working families but wants to end universal credit payments to foreign nationals.
Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, thank you. We're talking more about the choices facing Rachel Reeves at 10 past eight.
Now, at 20 to 7, Peter Sullivan spent more than 38 years in jail in what's believed to be the biggest miscarriage of justice in British history. The murder of 21-year-old Diane Sindall in Birkenhead in 1986 sparked the biggest manhunt Merseyside had ever seen. Still, no one has been caught. Peter's conviction was overturned and he was released earlier this year. He's now given his first interview to Phil McCann, a reporter for BBC Northwest. And I should also say that Peter asked that the BBC protect his identity and alter his voice so his future years are not defined by the crime he didn't commit. We'll hear a bit of that interview later on in the programme. But Phil joins us now. Phil, good morning.
Hi, Emma.
What has he been saying?
Well, he's been giving a very in-depth account of what happened when he was questioned by the police, and also the kind of position, I suppose, mentally that he's in now. So first of all, he talks about how when he was brought in by the police, and this was in the aftermath of a Crime Watch reconstruction, because Merseyside police hadn't made any progress for weeks in finding who had brutally murdered and sexually attacked Diane Sindall. He was brought in, and then he says he was bullied by the police into confessing to murdering her. Bullied by, well, he says that on two occasions he was assaulted, beaten up in his cell while they had a blanket over his head with batons. And he also says that the police threatened to get him charged with other crimes that he hadn't committed if he didn't confess to the crime. And that this was in over 2 days of being interviewed without a solicitor present and without an appropriate adult being present, because he has learning difficulties. So he told me it was difficult for him to understand, you know, the totality of what they were putting to him, and difficult for him to articulate the right kind of response. And he says that they asked him lots of leading questions, you know, you didn't do it like that, did you? That's not what happened, is it, Peter? So that the confessions that he gave sounded genuine. And then fast forward to today, he told me that he really just can't move on with his life if he doesn't get an apology from Merseyside Police, but also from the Crown Prosecution Service, but also B, some kind of an explanation as to, I don't think, why he was questioned, because there were witnesses who described somebody who the police believed was him, but because he just wants to know why things got so far. You know, when he initially denied this and then changed his answers to confessing to this, you know, even though, you know, he would say it clearly didn't check out, the details just weren't there. Why did he, why did the police put him forward to prosecutors? Why was he then prosecuted? He just struggles to understand this and just told me that he just can't move on with his life. He is also, I should say, optimistic about the future and really wants to see his team play, see Liverpool play. The last time he saw them play was at Prenton Park against Tranmere in 1986. Wow. He described how he watched the Berlin Wall falling down in prison. It's unbelievable to think about how long he was there and what he's been through.
38 years. Just quickly, Phil, what's he like? How does he come across?
Well, I said optimistic there, that's the right word. You know, chippy. His future obviously looks a lot better than his past looks. And he told me that when he was at the Court of Appeal back in May when he was freed, he just thought there'd be some kind of spanner in the works that would stop him from being released, because that had happened so many times before. And then when they finally did say, you know, the conviction was quashed, his appeal succeeds, you saw him breaking down and crying. And he said that was completely genuine. He'd never felt those kind of emotions in 38 years, because he thought that it wasn't going to happen. So it seems to me like he's thankful for every single day that he can, you know, walk outside and see daylight.
Phil McCann there. Thank you very much. We'll listen to some of that interview a bit later on in the programme.
It's 16 minutes to 7, just hours after the intelligence service, MI5, warned MPs and peers that they faced a significant risk of spying from China. The security minister was in the Commons yesterday in Parliament to set out a plan to tackle the threat. Here's Alicia McCarthy.
It seems there's a lot less glamour in spying these days. Gone are assignations in rainy alleyways, dead letter drops and furtive calls from phone boxes. Now espionage has apparently gone online.
Let me speak plainly. This activity involves a covert and calculated attempt by a foreign power to interfere with our sovereign affairs in favour of its own interests. And this government will not tolerate it.
That was the security minister, Dan Jarvis, after a warning from MI5 about people posing as online headhunters to get to sensitive information from parliamentarians, their staff and think tanks. China denies it's involved, saying the accusations of espionage are pure fabrication. But following the alert, Dan Jarvis set out a package of measures to tackle the threat, including increased penalties for election interference, investing in encrypted technology used by civil servants, and working with businesses to help protect their intellectual property. The UK and China, he stressed, must cooperate in areas where they shared an interest, like climate change. But
we will always, always challenge any country, including China, that attempts to interfere, influence, or undermine the integrity of our democratic institutions.
And he said the government could take further steps, including imposing sanctions. For the Conservatives, Alicia Cairns argued none of this should come as a surprise, and she had an example of the extent of China's influence.
Earlier this month, Norway and Denmark alerted us to the existence of dual-use kill switches in Chinese-made electric buses, allowing China to switch off buses and bring chaos to transport systems. So could the minister give an update on the investigation into our bus networks, but also the chips that have been placed in Ministry of Defence vehicles that require our members of the armed forces to be silent whilst travelling around our country in defence of our nation?
She urged ministers to do more, including cancelling forthcoming ministerial visits to China. A Lib Dem, Lisa Smart, welcomed the government's plan, but said on its own it wasn't enough.
Beijing has tried to bully our government, most recently on permission for the proposed new Chinese embassy in Towerbridge, warning of consequences if the government does not approve the plans. They have oppressed and intimidated British nationals. We cannot afford to shy away from this challenge and leave key pressing issues unresolved.
China plans to turn the historic former home of the Royal Mint in London into the largest embassy of any country in Europe. A decision is due before the end of the year. Reform UK's Richard Tice reckoned,
China smells weakness. And with regard to the embassy, Minister, whilst you say it's the decision for another minister, the reality is this is a strategically important decision by this government on behalf of the British people. And does the minister understand the British people will be shocked if planning consent is granted, and China will also smell weakness?
There was only a smattering of Labour MPs on the government benches, but one, Abtisam Mohammed, raised the experience of Professor Laura Murphy from Sheffield Hallam University in her constituency.
Whose excellent work on forced labour in China has been met with coercion, intimidation and attempts at interference linked to the Chinese state. At a time when universities are increasingly financially vulnerable due to a sharp decline in international student numbers, the risk of hostile states exploiting that vulnerability is growing.
And she urged the minister to provide more robust support for universities against pressure and intimidation. Conservative MPs lined up to air their worries about the UK's relationship with China. Sir Julian Lewis had this question.
Does the government accept that China is a bad faith actor whose basic technique can be summed up by a single phrase, buy influence and build dependency?
While his Tory colleague Andrew Murison had an even more succinct summary of the UK's reliance on China.
You can't reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth.
But the minister insisted pragmatism was the way forward while safeguarding national security.
Alita McCarthy reporting, our parliamentary correspondent there. It's 11 minutes to seven.
Just over 2 years ago, Dalia Saleh arrived in the UK as a master's student from Gaza. That was just before the October the 7th attacks. Her daughter, then aged six, stayed behind with her father. Since the summer, Dalia has been trying to arrange for her daughter to join her here in the UK. And earlier this year, the Home Office granted her a visa in principle as long as biometric tests were carried out. But Dalia's daughter is living in a tent in Gaza and can't get a biometric test. Let's speak to Dalia. She joins us now. Dalia, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just tell us a little bit about the backstory. When did you come here and to study what exactly?
Yes, thank you. So before leaving Gaza, I worked as a teacher of English for children for a few years. And I also took care of my daughter, who was 6 years old, as you mentioned, at the time I left Gaza. So I promised to return to her in 10 months, just after completing my master's degree at Durham University, where I obtained a prestigious scholarship. So I arrived in the UK in September 2023, and just almost 1 week or 10 days after I arrived, the war broke out in Gaza. The borders got closed, and I witnessed my family displacement multiple times and the famine and fear. And I lost contact with my daughter multiple times. And at one point, I had no contact with her for almost 2 months when I got so much terrified about her.
Of course, you must have wondered what's happening. So you initially thought you were going to stay here for 10 months and be without her and away from her for 10 months. Then you got a prestigious scholarship, which meant you stayed in the UK. Having established contact with her and wanting to bring her over, what did you do to try and bring her over to the UK from Gaza?
Yes, so... So now we have been separate for 2 years and 3 months, and I've got a scholarship to do my PhD in education at Cambridge University. So in
Congratulations.
August, thank you so much. So in August, I applied for her for a student dependent visa, which she is eligible for. And the Home Office or the UK government requested documents, which I submitted. And in early October, they gave her a visa in a principle subject to providing the biometrics data, her fingerprints, photocopy and other things. But the visa center in Gaza, where she's expected to visit and provide her biometrics, has been destroyed since the early days of the war. So my daughter has to leave Gaza to Jordan or to another country where she can provide her biometrics to process her visa. But the UK government hasn't provided me with any further instructions about or any evacuation plans about this thing.
I know
and
that they're
sending emails, contacted by MPs and so on. Yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, I know the government, I should put their point of view. They say, FCDO spokesperson said, the government is continuing to work to support students from Gaza and make it easier for them to bring their children, including working with other countries on transit arrangements. We continue to work on a series of cases. Obviously, they'd never comment on an individual case. But, you know, obviously one can completely understand the anguish you must feel in wanting to be reunited with your daughter. Presumably, it is incredibly hard, given the situation in Gaza, to, you know, conduct the operations necessary to get someone like your daughter out to somewhere where she can have the necessary tests.
Yes, I understand, but the time is not with our side. So every single day of delay puts my daughter in risk, and I've been waiting since early October to get response about evacuation plans. And my daughter has now lost almost 3 years of education. So last time I remember I was talking to her. She said, "Mom, I feel that I have the comprehension of reception level a child. I miss my school, and Mom, I don't want anything but just to be with you." And she sometimes sent photos and drawings, just putting us together. And she always asked the same question, "Mom, why are we separate? Why?
And when can we be reunited?" Well, we'll continue to take a close interest in the case. Thank you very, very much indeed for your time, for joining us this morning, Dahlia Saleh. Thank you.
It's 7 minutes to seven. After MPs and peers are told by MI5 they're being targeted by Chinese intelligence agents, ministers are now to meet university chiefs to discuss the risks posed by foreign interference. A key question: have UK universities allowed themselves to become too vulnerable to Chinese influence because they need those students? Vivian Stern, Chief Executive of Universities UK. Morning.
Morning.
Are universities feeling pressured by foreign influences, as what we're hearing?
I think universities are always a potential subject of attack or inappropriate attempts to influence what they do. And universities and government have to work together to counter the risks of that interference. They're real and they're serious. And we've worked for a very long time with the bits of government where people don't have surnames to try and ensure that if a university is subject to an attempt to influence how it works, they have got the support of government right behind them.
You say if. You say if. Is that happening at the moment? I'm just going to bring our listeners' attention to the fact that lawyers have claimed Sheffield Hallam University stopped a leading professor of human rights research into forced labour in China after facing pressure from Chinese authorities, something the university has denied, but it also has apologised to Professor Laura Murphy and committed now to supporting her research. There are those very concerned about those sorts of allegations and cases.
So I think in the case of Sheffield Hallam, and I really shouldn't talk in detail about that particular case because I wasn't involved, there was an attempt to pressure the institution. They did initially publish the research by Professor Murphy. They then faced an attempt to sue them for defamation, which created a real problem in getting professional indemnity insurance. They have published Professor Murphy's research. They've apologised to her for a previous decision not to support it. And I think the question for government is, what more can they do to support universities in that sort of position to push back against attempts to inappropriately influence what they're doing? So, for example, could government do more to protect academics from defamation or libel suits where they're working in their sort of academic field?
And while that's it's important to hear, and as you've just said, what you think government needs to be doing, but what about the robust measures that universities should have in place? There's a concern, as the Labour former Defence Minister Lord Kevin Jones says, who now chairs the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament, that universities have become dependent on the drug of Chinese student finance. Are universities doing enough?
So there's been a huge investment across the university system in resilience, basically the sort of the measures that universities need to take in order to understand the risks that exist when they're dealing with overseas partners, and to ensure that they've got good processes in place to understand what action they need to do to protect themselves from those risks.
Are they good enough?
We've got a university system which is really strongly intertwined with universities right around the world. And we've got a very large international student population. And both of those things are good. And actually, working with China in research is also important. China's the world's biggest producer of research.
I know, it's just trying to get a sense of whether it's good enough right now from the university's perspective, not just from what you're asking from government.
I think it's a dynamic threat, right? We have to keep
all right, Vivian Stern, I'm
sure
sorry,
we're
going to have to leave it there. We will return, I'm sure, to this. Vivian Stern, Chief Executive of Universities UK, thank you.
3 minutes to seven, continuing on Fridays on Radio 4.
I'm Anna Phoebe.
And I'm Jeffrey Bwachi. Add to Playlist is back with a new series.
The show that seeks out obscure and often surprising links between tracks.
What, for example, links this
to this?
And this
to this.
Hop on board for a serendipitous musical journey as we create a playlist of five tracks.
The new series of Add to Playlist.
On Friday nights at 7:15.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's get the weather forecast. Here's Simon King.
Thanks so much indeed. Yeah, lots going on this morning. We've had an area of rain, sleet and snow moving its way south and across parts of Wales, the Midlands, eastern and through southern areas of England. Much of the snow has fallen over higher ground, but you may be waking up this morning just to see a bit of a covering out there in some lower levels as well. Not likely to cause too much in the way of disruption. Risk of some ice as well. But that rain, sleet and snow does clear southward. There'll be plenty of sunshine developing across Wales, southwest England. Further wintry showers though in West Wales and the far southwest, and for eastern England we'll see a few showers coming in around the Wash. But it's across northern England, where in particular the northeast, that we're going to see frequent snow showers moving in. Already quite snowy in some parts this morning. We could see up to 25 centimetres through today and tomorrow in parts of the North York Moors, the Yorkshire Wolds. An amber warning is in force from the Met Office to cover that. Significant disruption is likely because of that snow. A similar story for northern and eastern areas of Scotland. Frequent heavy snow showers moving in here. Again, lots accumulating over higher ground. Sunshine elsewhere across Scotland. After Northern Ireland, there'll be a few wintry showers today. A brisk northerly wind across the UK, making it feel cold.
Simon, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Amol Rajan.
Good morning. If you're just joining us, it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 19th of November. The headlines. Scottish fans have been celebrating after the men's football team dramatically qualified for the World Cup, ending a wait of nearly three decades. Congress has backed moves to force the Justice Department to release documents linked to the late paedophile and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And the final inflation figure before the budget next week is due to be issued shortly.
Yes, we'll be looking at that in just a few moments. Also coming up in the next hour, do we now have definitive research showing that ultra-processed foods cause chronic disease? We'll ask Dr. Chris Van Tulleken at 7:30. And of course, continuing the sporting theme this morning, another great competition gets underway on Friday. We're going to be looking forward to the Ashes with the great Australian cricket writer, Gideon Haigh. The BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
Scotland's men have qualified for the Football World Cup for the first time since 1998 with a dramatic 4-2 win over Denmark in injury time at Hampden Park in Glasgow. Steve Clarke's side needed a win to ensure a place in the tournament, but they twice lost the lead before making a decisive breakthrough to turn around their World Cup fortunes. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss was watching the match at Hampden Park.
Scotland are going to the World Cup!
An unforgettable finish to a quite unforgettable night as Scotland ended their long World Cup wait in barely believable fashion. Needing to beat Denmark to qualify, their hopes seemed over with a score 2-2 going into injury time.
But it's fallen to Tierney!
But Kieran Tierney fired them ahead before, from the halfway line, Kenny McLean sealed their qualification in sensational style.
He's knocked it from the halfway line, it's over Schmeichel! What a goal from Kenny McLean!
Scotland's captain Andy Robertson said the win was a testament to his team's resilience.
That just sums up this squad. Never say die. We just keep going right to the end, and one of the craziest games of football. We've certainly put the country through it. I'm sure it'll be all worth it.
It's certainly been some roller coaster for Scotland. They had toiled in recent matches, losing to Greece at the weekend. But they rose to the occasion at the perfect time. And after 28 years of heartache, finally, gloriously, the World Cup beckons.
Wales are still in contention to qualify for the tournament after thrashing North Macedonia in Cardiff. Their 7-1 win ensures they'll play their World Cup semi-final playoff at home. Figures released in the past few minutes show that the rate of inflation slowed slightly last month. The rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, eased to 3.6% after standing at 3.8% in September. It's the last set of inflation figures before next week's budget. Both chambers of Congress have voted to force the Justice Department to publish files from the investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. After making a U-turn on the issue, President Trump now says he'll sign the bill into law as soon as he gets it. He had previously described the campaign to release files as a Democrat-led hoax. From Washington, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
For months, Donald Trump has resisted calls to release the Epstein files, even as many of his own supporters have been clamouring for him to make the information public. Now the bill has been passed by Congress, he will have to decide shortly whether or not to sign it into law. He's said he is prepared to do so, but if he really wanted to, he could have published the files without congressional approval. President Trump has grown obviously frustrated at the constant attention on Epstein. In a social media post, he said he didn't want Republicans to take their eyes off all the victories he says they've had, referencing immigration and the economy. If he signs the legislation, the Justice Department will have 30 days to release the files, which campaigners believe will reveal the names of rich and powerful men who participated in the abuse of many of Epstein's victims.
A man freed after being jailed for 38 years in one of the UK's longest miscarriages of justice has told the BBC he was bullied into falsely confessing to the murder of a 21-year-old woman on Merseyside. Peter Sullivan was speaking in his first interview since his release 6 months ago. He was cleared after new DNA evidence proved he wasn't the killer. Phil McCann has the details. In the report, Mr. Sullivan's voice has been disguised to protect his identity.
Peter Sullivan wasn't allowed access to a solicitor when he confessed in an unrecorded interview to sexually attacking and murdering Diane Sindall in Birkenhead in 1986. Now he's told the BBC he was beaten up in police custody, and officers threatened to link him to a series of rapes he hadn't committed if he didn't confess. Merseyside Police says it has no details of those allegations. Mr. Sullivan says he now wants an explanation and an apology.
I can't carry on with my life if I can't get an answer of them. That's all I want is an apology for the reason why they've done this to me.
The force says it regrets that there's been a grave miscarriage of justice in this case. Its investigation into the murder is ongoing.
A British woman and four other tourists have died after becoming caught in a snowstorm in Chile. The Chilean authorities say the group became lost on a hiking circuit in one of the country's most famous national parks, Torres del Paine. They faced blizzard conditions and wind speeds reaching more than 100 miles an hour. Four people were rescued. A parliamentary aide who was targeted by a social media account suspected of being run by Chinese spies has described what happened as deeply worrying. MPs, peers and parliamentary staff have been warned by MI5 that two profiles on the networking site LinkedIn are being used by Beijing. Here's our political correspondent, Georgia Roberts.
Simon Welband is a researcher for the Conservative MP Neil O'Brien, who was sanctioned by China in 2021. Mr. Welband said he discovered the message, which the BBC has seen, on his LinkedIn account from one of the profiles which the intelligence services believe are being used on behalf of the Chinese Ministry of State Security. The message, sent 3 months ago, was written in poor English, offering a job opportunity involving remote working. He never responded and reported it to Parliament's security services. Mr. Welburn said he feared more junior staff could be fooled by this sort of message and thinks espionage attempts are becoming more common around Parliament. The Chinese embassy in the UK said accusations of espionage were pure fabrication.
MPs have warned that the UK is over-reliant on the United States for its defence and underprepared for an armed attack. The chair of the Defence Select Committee, Tan Desi, said the government must urgently prioritise homeland defence and resilience. Here's our political correspondent, Ben Wright.
For the government, ramping up weapons production is a military and economic imperative. In a speech at Westminster, the Defence Secretary John Healey will say ministers have identified 13 potential sites for private companies to build at least 6 new armaments factories. Mr. Healey is expected to say the government is making defence an engine for growth. But from the Defence Select Committee comes a blunt warning about Britain's readiness for attack. It calls for closer cooperation with European countries and a coordinated effort to communicate with the public on what to expect in the event of conflict.
The number of days taken to deal with shoplifting cases has risen by more than 80% in the past decade, figures obtained by the BBC have found. Police in England and Wales recorded more than 500,000 shoplifting offences in the year to June. Retailers who've been targeted say the time it takes to bring shoplifters to justice is unacceptable. Tom Hurst heads security at the store Austin's in Newton Abbot.
Every time somebody comes in and steals something, at the end of the day, that cost gets passed on.
Who is it getting passed on to?
The public. Anybody that's shopping to buy. It puts the price up, so we're all paying.
Scientists have traced the origins of kissing, which they say evolved more than 21 million years ago. Researchers examined evidence from the different species of primates that kiss each other. Our science correspondent, Victoria Gill, has more on this romantic tale.
Humans do it, chimpanzees do it, even polar bears do it. But the mouth-on-mouth kiss is something of a biological puzzle with no obvious survival or reproductive benefits. The Oxford University-led team gathered evidence of animals that kiss each other on the mouth and worked out their evolutionary relationship to each other and to humans. This revealed that kissing probably evolved in the last common ape ancestor of humans, chimps and bonobos. The researchers hope the insight will encourage more scientists to gather data that could explain why we and many other animals kiss.
Victoria Gill reporting.
Good to know. A relief all round. It is 9 minutes past seven.
Listen, I've been a nurse for the NHS for the last 3 years. One through COVID, and this is the best feeling I've ever had. Come on for all the nurses. We love us.
Go on! Yes! Best day of my life.
How was it?
Yes! The sheer joy of fans who have waited 28 years for Scotland, or will have done by the time they're actually going to compete, to qualify to compete in the World Cup, and a dramatic victory over Denmark to do so.
I'm proud to be Scottish! Come on to Scotland!
What was it like when that first goal went in?
Pure madness.
Bad one.
It was just unreal. Right. I couldn't believe it. Started crying. But yeah, just delighted.
The score was 2-2 going into injury time. Anxious faces everywhere before a dramatic finale. Scotland scored in the 93rd minute, and then one last moment of pure magic captured on Radio Scotland magnificently by our colleagues Alistair Lamont and Michael Stewart.
Scotland just needs to hold out for a few more seconds. My voice just needs to hold out for a few more seconds. As Gilman has it, he's surrounded. He pokes the ball back. Surely now Scotland will hold on to possession. It's McLean. He's looking to go for goal from halfway line. It's Chip Smith. Glorious! Glorious! Kenny McLean.
What a night listening to that. Archie McPherson, the legendary Scottish football commentator who knows a thing or two. He's been commentating on the national team since the 1970s. He joins us on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. I'll tell you what, there was a lot of evolutionary kissing going on last night.
I did think
all over the land, from John O'Groats and so on.
I did think that might link.
Well, you know, I thought, really, in about 50 years of broadcasting and following Scotland all over the world, I thought I had seen everything. I obviously hadn't. I mean, the ending was just tremendous. I hate to say this of the Danes, but Hans Christian Andersen couldn't have scripted it better. It was just astonishing. And the thing is this, my incredulity, which has lasted all night, I hope it sounded all right, because I didn't get any sleep at all. And because although we had that opening goal, this tremendous overhead acrobatic kick, which was electric. Now, that will be considered one of the greatest Scottish goals of all time. I personally think Archie Gemmell's goal in Mendoza in 1978 was a great goal. That was a goal of poetry of motion. This was acrobatic and spectacular and lightning. It was almost as if it was a hunting horn for Scotland to go after more blood. The fact is, the Danes took over after that, particularly when we lost Ben Gannon Doak, from a hamstring injury, and he was the much more inventive and pacey player in the Scottish team. And that had an effect on the players because the Danes took over. They controlled the game. They possessed the ball. We couldn't get hold of it. Craig Gordon in the Scottish goal, who's in his 40s, was tremendous. The ball was scraping the crossbar, hitting the post. It was very, very difficult to watch. And then when they got the equaliser, the penalty, which lasted, to me, an eternity before they decided that it was a penalty kick, I wrote Scotland off. At that point, I thought, no, they'll score again. Then when the other goal went in, the Lauren Shanklin goal 20 minutes later, poking it in from close in, he's renowned for doing that. That was it. They came back. Patrick Doggo, Manchester United player, scored a lovely goal, 2-2. And then came that tremendous ending. Kieran Tierney, back in Scottish football for the first time in a long while. He's not a noted goal scorer, but this 25-yard shot that drove into the net was tremendous. And then the ending, very special. It was almost as if somebody was saying, let's do it in slow motion.
Yes.
Because Kenny McLean from the halfway line looks up, sees Schmeichel, the Celtic goalkeeper, out of his goal, just outside the penalty area, and he lofts this ball, and it hovers and hovers, and you wonder, where is it going to go? Tantalizingly. And it just gets over the goalkeeper into the net, and we're in the World Cup for the first time in 28 years, as you said. My voice is going.
It was a magnificent rendition, though, despite the fact you've not slept. And the elation that we could hear from fans and how much it will mean to
it does.
To qualify and to be there.
It does indeed. Remember, Scottish football is in a bad way at the moment in the sense that we are renowned for our football. We gave football to the world, remember. We produced great characters, the Matt Busbys, the Jock Steens, the Bill Shankly's and so on. But lately, English clubs, even outside the Championship, are able to pay players better than the Scottish clubs. And given that, we've been performing very poorly in European football. And now it rests on the Scottish team to, in a sense, redeem the Scottish reputation for football.
Well, Archie, I'm gonna let you get some sleep. It was very, very good to hear your views and your elation this morning, as well as those fans. Archie McPherson, thank you.
7:15, the UK inflation rate has just been announced and it's dipped just a bit. It's gone a little bit lower to 3.6% in the year to October. Let's speak to Grant Fitzner, Chief Economist at the Office for National Statistics. Grant, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
Please give us your sort of assessment, overall assessment of what the what's going on here.
Yes, a dip in the annual headline inflation rate, broadly in line with expectations. The main driver, and I don't think anyone was surprised by this, was gas and electricity prices. So they did increase a small amount in October, but by less, substantially less than this time last year. Two other factors also came into play. The cost of hotels was also a downward driver, with prices down in the latest month, and that was partly offset by higher food prices, which, following their dip last month, have gone back up. So the annual rate for food and non-alcoholic beverages has gone from 4.5% to 4.9%.
Which is still a huge amount, isn't it? Because food is a big part of the outgoings of people, particularly from poorer backgrounds. What about the cost of raw materials for business?
Yes, we've resumed our producer price series, and that is showing an interesting trend over the last couple of months. Small increases in what we call input costs, that's the cost of raw materials, higher increases in factory gate prices, so manufactured goods. And I think what we're seeing there is after several years where those big cost of living increases have compressed manufacturers' margins, they are gradually starting to rebuild their margins through that differential. But another factor there, I think, is in addition to higher input costs, companies also facing obviously other additions to costs as well. The wage increases we saw earlier this year, one of the factors that that businesses are reporting is weighing on and profitability. And some of that, of course, is being passed through into higher prices.
Yes, exactly. And just go back to food for a second, Grant, which is the thing that will concern a lot of people, especially those from poorer backgrounds. Why is food price inflation so high? Why does it seem so high and so sticky, close to 5%?
Well, I think this is a sector that's had a very big reduction in profitability over the last couple of years. A lot of the increases in costs in raw materials, for example, and energy over the last couple of years were not passed through to consumers. Now that headline inflation has come down, we're seeing some attempt, it would appear, to kind of rebuild some of those margins. But as I said, that's quite gradual.
Mm.
Profitability rates of return are still quite low in most parts of manufacturing.
Okay. And a broad final thought, just why is UK inflation more broadly more stubborn than in other major economies?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, going back to food for a moment, if you actually look at how food prices have changed in the UK compared with Europe over the last couple of years, they've been almost exactly in line. So I think a lot of what we've seen in recent years reflects global trends, but there has been a divergence more recently, and I don't think it's one single factor. One of the things, of course, that has weighed on prices over the last few years compared with some comparable European countries, France would be a good example, is that we're more reliant on gas and less reliant on other energy sources such as nuclear. That's a factor in terms of energy prices. But there are other factors as well. As I said, we've certainly seen some regulatory cost increases. We've seen higher minimum wages and quite a few people in areas such as food manufacturing on relatively low wages. So that passes through. But there are other factors as well.
Grant Fitzner, Chief Economist at the Office for National Statistics. Thank you. So inflation down a bit to 3.6%.
19 minutes past seven. Peter Sullivan spent more than 38 years in jail in what's believed to be the biggest miscarriage of justice in British history. 38 years. The murder of 21-year-old Diane Sindall in Birkenhead in 1986 sparked the biggest manhunt Merseyside had ever seen. Still no one, we should say, has been caught for the murder of Diane. Peter's conviction was overturned and he was released earlier this year. He asked that we protect his identity and alter his voice in this interview so his future years are not defined by the crime he didn't commit. He's now given his first interview to Phil McCann, a reporter for BBC Northwest, who started by asking about what he wants to happen next.
I can't forgive him for what he's done to me, because it's going to be there for the rest of my life. I've got to carry that burden until I can get an apology of what happened from everyone else who's been involved with the case. That's all I want, is an apology for the reason why they've done this to me.
From Merseyside Police?
From Merseyside Police and everyone else. I lost all my freedom. I lost my mother since I was in prison. I've lost my father. And it hurts because I wasn't there for them. I have never been able to set myself to go and see my mum's grave. And I can't carry on with my life if I can't get an answer of them. That is what I need the most, is an answer from them. And that's all I care about, is that answer. Why did you done it to me?
And when you were in prison, and when you got out of prison, did you think a lot about Diane Sindall's family, knowing that the wrong person would be put in prison for?
I feel sorry for them. I really do feel sorry for them. And what they're going through at the moment, where they're back at square one and not knowing who the person is that killed their daughter. I don't know what to say to them. I am really sorry for what's happened to the daughter. And if they need, and if they want my support when they go to court with the guy, when they find him, I will go to court with them. I will be there by their side 100%, because I will be there for them.
That's Peter Sullivan's, an excerpt from his first interview that's given to Phil McCann. And in a statement to the BBC, Merseyside Police said the investigation was conducted nearly 40 years ago. Changes had now been made to how those placed under arrest are treated. And they added, they understand the detrimental impact the conviction has had on the life of Mr. Sullivan and said we are doing everything we can to find out who the new DNA evidence which formed the basis of his release belongs to. The Crown Prosecution Service told us the prosecution case was brought on the basis of all the evidence available to them at the time. Well, Peter Sullivan's solicitor, Sarah Myatt, who's been representing him for over 20 years, is on the line and was listening to that. In terms of Sarah, this reality that he's now in and how he is since his release, what can you say of that?
Well, I say, first of all, that he is such a brave, humble man, isn't he? The comments that he's just made that we've heard during that clip. He is slowly reintegrating into society, rebuilding his life. But, of course, that's going to be a long process for him. And this will stay with him forever.
Why did you believe him for all this time? What was it for you?
It was the way that he was, and that he knew that, given he'd received a life sentence, and he knew that he could work towards an application at the parole board by accepting responsibility for the offence, doing the relevant coursework and working towards releasing that way. And he was just adamant that he would never accept responsibility because he just hadn't committed the offence. And he knew that that would lead to him potentially staying in prison longer. But he never wavered with that.
So you are, of course, standing by him at the same time to try and help and support. What is next, do you think? An apology from Merseyside Police, compensation? How does the future look on that side of things?
Well, that is something that Switolskis are working to support him with and will continue to do so. In terms of compensation, it's really not an easy process or a quick process. That has to be done in a very regimented way, and the application does take quite some time. But we continue to represent him and support him with that.
Thanks very much. Sarah Myatt there, Peter Sullivan's solicitor. She's represented him for over 20 years. A Ministry of Justice spokesperson has said, Peter Sullivan suffered a grave miscarriage of justice and our thoughts are with him and the family of Diane Sindall. We are committed to supporting individuals in rebuilding their lives, which is why we have raised compensation caps by 30% and will carefully consider the Law Commission's findings as they consult on criminal appeals and compensation for miscarriages of justice.
24 minutes past seven. Let's go back to Sean with the business. Because, Sean, profits and sales are up at one of the UK's biggest tech companies, at Sage Group, and presumably this is to do with the adoption of AI.
Yeah, it's one of those sort of real-life examples. We hear the headlines about the big tech giants all around the world, but Sage providing accounting and payroll software to businesses here in the UK, around the world as well. One of the biggest companies on our stock markets. It's mentioned today that the use of artificial intelligence agents in its products are a reason behind its growth, something I spoke about with Steve Hare, who's the chief executive of Sage.
No small business owner says, hey, I must buy some more AI. What they're doing is consuming things which are saving them time, which AI is enabling them to do. So, I mean, the real focus here is, you know, automating processes, you know, giving people, putting things into people's hands that save them time so that they can focus on running their business. And, you know, that's something that we've been doing for years, but it's definitely increasing. And, you know, we're starting to see real adoption from our customers.
And when you see businesses increasingly saving time, what are they doing with that saved time? Are they reducing headcount, reallocating those resources elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, they're tending to reallocate. I mean, I think, you know, when you speak to small business owners, they all say the same thing. They all say they're really time hungry, that they, you know, they didn't go into business to spend time on admin, you know, they're reallocating their time to really look for ways to grow their business. So, you know, they're focusing on their personal productivity, the productivity of their business, and trying to find ways to grow their businesses.
Do you see if they're retraining those staff that don't need to do those tasks anymore, or are those roles going and they're recruiting in other roles?
No, small business owners tend to just reallocate because they, you know, they're small, they employ relatively few numbers of people. And so, you know, those people tend to be multitasking anyway. And so if they can free up time, you know, somebody who was previously doing admin, you know, will help to try and, you know, find new customers, support the operations of the business, you know, in small businesses. People do lots of things all at the same time.
And hearing from the boss of Google this week, amongst many things, saying, don't blindly trust AI. For an industry like you're in, where this is payrolls, this is the way businesses are run, and very important that it's right. Does it come with some risks for you as well if you're starting to use AI agents?
Yeah, I think this is really important. We've really focused on developing our own domain-specific large language models because, as you say, accuracy, is super, super important. So what we've done is our agents are, you know, the ones we've launched tend to be quite narrow. So they do a particular task. So we've launched a VAT agent that you know, does VAT returns, rather than going really wide, because when you go wide, you dramatically increase the risk of inaccuracy. So we're automating specific things and really focusing on using our local domain expertise to achieve accuracy.
Steve Hare, Chief Executive of Sage, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Sean, thank you. Let's cross over now to Mike with the latest on the sport. More glory, I'm hoping.
Oh, absolutely. This morning, this day, doesn't it, belongs to Scotland because they have the world at their feet.
Good evening. How's the nerves? One win, just one win, and almost three decades of failure will fade into the annals.
He's going to shoot. Is that going in? That's unbelievable! I have never seen anything quite as incredible and dramatic to absolutely rubber stamp Scotland's place. And the World Cup, absolutely astonishing!
Yes, a night no one at Hampden will ever forget. A 4-2 win for Scotland over Denmark, securing their first World Cup appearance since 1998. Well, Pat Nevin, former Scotland winger, was one of those lucky enough to be there last night and witness it all, and he's back on the programme this morning. Hi, Pat.
Good morning.
We have spoken to you on this programme many times, haven't we, at moments of great despair for the Scottish national team. So what a fillip this morning to talk to you in these happy circumstances.
Yeah, look, there have been some good times, some bad times, some boring times, some whatever. This was magical. There was almost not the word for it. It was unbelievable to such a level that you've just played all those lovely, beautiful, still spine-tingling little clips there, and I'm still moved by it, and also very pleased that you didn't play Mine in the background there. I'd probably be embarrassed by them, because you want to stay in control, but no one who was watching, who was playing, who was involved in any way whatsoever, listening, could feel anything else other than, isn't football, when it's like that, the most magical, fantastic, joyous thing?
And so say all of us. I have to ask you about Steve Clarke. No manager has ever taken Scotland to three major tournaments. He has now just done that. Greatest ever Scotland manager?
Well, by the figures, yes. I mean, there are other Scotland managers that have done brilliant things, and I wouldn't want to denigrate anything they have done in their entire careers. But as a Scotland manager, no one has done as much as this. And apart from it, it was a moment right at the end. There are so many moments that night, and everybody watching who's Scottish will feel a different one or ones. But there was a moment after the game where you thought, hold the back page, that smile of Stevie Clarke, I have never seen it before. We've known each other since we were 19 or 20, and I've never seen a look in his face like it. And he just encapsulated what an entire nation felt, and all that relief was like a waterfall. It was like a tsunami. It was amazing for everybody to be part of it as well. And the stadium was rocking, the game was great, the story was incredible, and as you showed there, the goals were amazing.
Well, what about the goals, Pat? If you were to do a list of the top five Scotland goals of all time, there's a very strong case, isn't there, that three of those five were scored last night?
Yeah, I mean, the first goal, McTominay, the overhead kick. I mean, I was at the game when Cristiano Ronaldo scored an overhead kick for Real Madrid against Juventus, best goal I've ever seen in a stadium. And that was right up there with it. So yeah, that's the standard you're talking about. And then the goal that was scored at the end by Kenny McLean, well, that was Beckham way back when he made his name and scored from the halfway line. It was absolutely extraordinary. That's before you get to Kieran Tierney's whipped-in ball that Mo Salah would be delivering. delighted with it. He's very, very best. So, yeah, again, you could not make this up. It was so, if you did, you would just feel laughed.
They are incredible goals. You can watch them all and extended highlights right now on the BBC website and app. Pat Nevin, will let you continue to soak it in. Many thanks this morning. And Amal and Emma, we should say this is a moment for all of Scotland. So only right we share this. Here is commentary of Kieran Tierney's goal in Gaelic, as heard on BBC Radio Nagael.
Nes ychydig o Machilian. Machilian, dolo hwgar bawl y ddi eisiach yn y bocs. Go, ymwyl o bocs. Nes ychydig Prisgwyth o lan. Eto hyd yn cael Kieran Tierney! Goal! Kieran Tierney! Hafôn! Hafôn a chael Kieran Tierney! Ei dda, bych yn y chlein y gamil y gadw yn aflwyd. Hafôn 3 minutes.
It doesn't matter what language you speak, does it? The pure unbridled joy there of Scotland, all of Scotland this morning. They are on their way to the World Cup.
It probably makes more sense in some ways.
It does. Lots and lots of ways. Wonderful. Mike, thank you so much. More from you again, of course, in an hour. It is 27 minutes to 8 and time to say good morning to the great Michael Burke, who can tell us about the moral maze.
Morning, Amal. Morning, Emma. A DNA analysis of Hitler's blood, taken from the sofa on which he was sitting when he shot himself, shows he had a very high predisposition, top 1% in fact, to autism, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Now, it's not a diagnosis, still less an exculpatory explanation of his character and the terrible evils that he wreaked. But it does raise the question of moral luck. How much genetic inheritance, upbringing and circumstance, all out of our control, play a part in shaping the people we become and the things that we do? And where does all this leave agency, responsibility, blame? Moral luck, the moral maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Looking forward to it, Michael. Thank you, as ever. A look at the weather now. Windy and cold today, with wintry showers moving in from the north. Drier with sunny spells inland. I'm sorry, it's not better news.
Coming up in a few minutes, Dr. Chris Van Tulleken, author of Ultra-Processed People, on the latest research into ultra-processed food.
It is indeed something we need to think about. And you're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 26 minutes to 8. We've both had a very wholesome breakfast. And now a summary of the news from Lisa Costello.
Scotland's men have qualified for the Football World Cup for the first time since 1998 with a dramatic 4-2 win over Denmark in injury time at Hampden Park in Glasgow. Steve Clarke's side needed a win to ensure a place in the tournament, but they twice lost the lead before making a decisive breakthrough, scoring 2 goals right at the end of the match. The rate of inflation slowed slightly last month. The rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, eased to 3.6% in the year to October after standing at 3.8% the month before. It's the last set of inflation figures before the budget. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, said while the fall was good news for households and businesses, she was determined to do more to bring prices down. Victims of the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have welcomed the US Congress passing legislation to try to force the Justice Department to release documents from its criminal investigation into him. After making a U-turn on the issue, President Trump now says he'll sign the bill into law as soon as he gets it. A parliamentary aide who was targeted by a social media account suspected of being run by Chinese spies has described the incident as deeply worrying. MPs, peers and parliamentary staff have been warned by MI5 that 2 profiles on the networking site LinkedIn were used to try to collect information for Beijing. The Chinese embassy in London has dismissed the claims. The number of days it takes to deal with shoplifting cases has risen by more than 80% in the past decade, according to figures obtained by the BBC. Police in England and Wales recorded more than 500,000 shoplifting offences in the year to June. Scientists have traced the origins of kissing, which they say evolved more than 21 million years ago. Researchers examined evidence from the different species of primates that kiss each other to reach their findings.
Lisa, thank you so much. A giant conspiracy to promote addiction, spread chronic disease and cause us to lead shorter, sicker lives. That's what ultra-processed foods are, essentially, though we paraphrase a bit. According to a major paper published in the Lancet Medical Journal today. It's co-sponsored by 43 scientists and researchers. They argue that so-called UPFs, ultra-processed foods, are linked to multiple chronic diseases. Professor Chris Van Tulliken is Professor of Infection and Global Health at University College London. One of the authors of that study is the co-host of the What's Up Docs podcast and show on Radio 4, and also author of the influential book Ultra Processed People. Professor Van Tulliken, good morning.
Good morning, Amal.
I did call you a doctor a moment ago, but that's because you used to do that. You've now upgraded beyond doctor. You're a professor. What are ultra processed foods?
It's a formal term. It's not like junk foods or fast foods. It's a scientific definition. The definition is now used by the World Health Organization, the United Nations, UNICEF, and hundreds of research groups around the world. And this is a series of three papers published in the world's preeminent medical journal, The Lancet. We're launching it this evening at the Royal College of Physicians. And this series of papers establishes that a diet high in ultra-processed food does cause health harms. It's not merely associated with other health-harming behaviors. In simple terms, to understand what UPFs are, imagine you're running a food company. To make more money than Emma's food company, you've got two options. Drop the price of ingredients, so replace your dairy fat with palm fats, your eggs with emulsifiers, your strawberries with flavorings. And then you have to engineer your food so that it doesn't satisfy your customers. They eat as much of it as they can, as often as they can. And that's the project of transnational food corporations. It's not an unreasonable project. It's what they're designed and meant to do. But they're ineffectively regulated. And we know they use the same techniques as the tobacco industry to market the food, to distort the evidence, and indeed to develop the food.
May I humbly push back on a fellow Radio 4 presenter and put some objections to your position from some other scientists and professors? Professor Jules Griffin from the University of Aberdeen says the authors had shown, quote, a wide range of chronic diseases are associated with increased consumption of UPFs, but, quote, association may not be causation, as the authors freely admit.
We definitely say association is not always causation, but there are formal criteria. When you look at population studies, and we've done a formal meta-analysis of more than 100 of the kind of studies that did establish a causal link between tobacco products and lung cancer. We've looked at more than 100 of these studies. And then when you say we're going to try and establish causal inference, you have a set of formal criteria. There are several of them. We use the Bradford Hill criteria, where you say, in addition to excellently conducted epidemiological studies, is there experimental evidence? Is this evidence plausible? Do we see dose responses? Do we see the same effect in different populations? Do different research groups around the world find the same thing? And so at this point, we can say it has satisfied all of the criteria that it could possibly satisfy. And so I think it is no longer scientific to assert that a dietary pattern high in UPF does not cause health harm.
Which health harms or chronic diseases does it cause?
So there are 12 different outcomes that we looked at, which ranges from the obvious ones like obesity and metabolic disease like type 2 diabetes through to cardiometabolic and cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, cancers, gastrointestinal disease, depression and early death from all causes.
And you assert that is now causal. Okay, let me put to you objection number two. Kevin McConway, Emeritus Professor of Applied Statistics at the Open University, says, and I quote, this certainly doesn't establish that all UPFs increase disease risk. There's little evidence of an increase in cancer risk, for instance.
Definitely not all UPFs are equal, and we don't assert that. The evidence is around a dietary pattern. So UPFs make up about 60 to 70% of our diet on average in the UK, our calories. Is there a strong link to cancer? Not at the moment, but the way we conducted the research was very conservative, so we've probably underestimated. But the links to obesity, cardiovascular disease, these are very strong, and I think there is a growing consensus about the dietary pattern. Individual products, it's harder. You need different tools to assess individual products.
Okay. Other objections are less to do with the scientific rigor or otherwise of your paper. As you say, it's published in the world's preeminent medical journal. But one objection might be that the food industry is already on the case. So the Food and Drink Federation say that most foods that are on sale across shops and supermarkets now contain a third less salt and sugar and a quarter fewer calories than they did in 2015. That might be thanks to the work of people like Dr. Chris Van Tulliken and his best-selling books. But there's a second objection, which is that isn't there a danger that UPFs often being consumed by people who don't have a huge amount of money, what you might end up doing, and I know you're sensitive to this, you might end up in a situation where people who do have lots of time and money end up wagging their finger at those who don't.
The authorship, unusually, of this series of papers in The Lancet is predominantly from the Global South, from Central and Latin America and from Sub-Saharan Africa. And that is because ultra-processed foods are an issue of social justice, of climate justice, of food sovereignty and of food security. And contrary to the arguments of the food industry, they make all those problems worse. And the authorship reflects a very committed desire amongst all of us, amongst the community of scientists who study this, to improve justice and equity. So what we argue for very strongly is better access to healthy food. I should say these comments that are coming in, there were about 15 comments submitted through the Science Media Centre itself, a food industry funded press office. Of those, we did an analysis of these yesterday when we had an authors meeting. About a quarter of them were strongly negative. Of the strongly negative comments, every single person, every single scientist had an institutional or individual conflict of interest with an ultra-processed food company. The 75% of good comments were from independent scientists. As you say, it's in The Lancet. It's been peer-reviewed. This is sanctioned by WHO and UNICEF.
Look forward to getting the right reply from all of them. As you'd expect, you get a bit of pushback on this programme. That's how we test arguments. Dr. Chris Van Tulleken, thank you very much indeed for joining us, author of Ultra-Processed People.
Fascinating. 17 minutes to 8.
Now, how's this for a submission to the Impartiality Police? On Friday, the greatest contest in all sporting history, perhaps in all human history, is renewed down under.
Here's Willis in, bowls to Bright. Bright bowled! The middle stumps out of the ground. England have won. They've won by 18 runs. Willis runs around, punching the air. The boys invade the ground, and the players run helter-skelter for the pavilion.
Shane Warne, off only two or three paces, he bowls, and Gatting is taken on the pace, bowled!
Harmison comes up and bowls, and Kasparovic goes back, and parries one as he caught down the leg side. There's an appeal for catches out. England have won!
And in comes Pat Cummins from the far end. He bowls to Stokes, who hammers it for four!
Yeah, just because we didn't have quite enough sporting commentary on the programme this morning. That, in case you were wondering, is the Ashes. They start Friday, 2:30 a.m. if you want to set your alarm. England's squad is in Australia. They're getting a bit of a rough time from the Australian media, as you might expect. Cricket lends itself to great writing, doesn't it? And few cricket writers in the world today are more venerated than the Australian Gideon Haigh, who joins us now. Gideon, good morning.
G'day, Emil. Look, I've got chills. That radio commentary. It's the quality, isn't it, of cricket incident that you, the minute that you hear something like that, you automatically think, where was I when that happened? And it instantly sets off a chain of memories.
But what is the peculiar magic of the Ashes, Gideon?
Continuity, for one thing, been going for so long. Shared success, even though there have been long periods where both England and Australia have dominated, it's always reverted to a pretty tight contest. Great characters, incredible characters with long careers. You know, cricketers have long careers at the top. You know, Brabham was 20 years at the top. That's a long time to leave an impression. And of course, it's a long game. You know, it's the longest game of all, and in that time, there's plenty of scope for the imagination to work.
And epic drama. One of the things about cricket, Gideon, which you've written about so well for many years, is that because it's the imperial game, it was sort of empire by other means, the weight of history is always very tangible. There's always that element of spice that everyone thinks that their contest against England, the former imperial power, is the most important one, and they really want to do them over.
Yeah, we're always trying to get away from the Ashes in Australia. We're always trying to sort of separate ourselves, say it doesn't matter all that much, you know. In the end, you know, test matches are a bit anachronistic. Five test series, they're a bit long, aren't they? India's where the money is, it's where the glamour is. But there's just no doubt that when England arrive in Australia, people lose their sense of proportion.
Final thought, Gideon, give us your prediction.
Look, I think Sir Leonard Hutton once said you have to be 25% better than Australia to beat them down under. And I think with the best will in the world, this England team is not that much better. It's very good. This is going to be an extremely competitive Ashes series, and the absence with injury of Cummins and Hazelwood has closed the balance between the two teams. But I think home ground advantage is still just too much. You know, England haven't won a test match here for 15 years. Just as we haven't won a test series in England since 2001, home ground advantage really counts. But, you know, at the end, every series these days is a kind of a referendum on the future of test cricket, and I'm genuinely hoping that it's decided in test cricket's favour.
Very diplomatically put. Gideon Haigh, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
14 minutes to 8. It is time now for Thought for the Day, and the speaker this morning, Tim Stanley, Catholic commentator and writer for the Daily Telegraph.
Good morning. Today is International Men's Day, the concept of which I am very suspicious. My gender has its problems: low self-esteem, violence, addiction, uncertainty about what it means to be male. But many of us are resistant to therapy, and the self-pitying man is almost as unattractive as the muscle-bound influencer shouting at me to drink protein on Instagram. Like a lot of men, I don't like talking about being a man. I don't much enjoy talking at all. It's striking that in one of the best ads for the Christmas season, that's for John Lewis, the male characters say nothing. A son doesn't know how to talk to his dad. He buys his dad an LP. His dad hugs him. Neither expresses themselves vocally. They don't have to, because actions say it all. Likewise, the most prominent dad in the New Testament, besides God, is completely silent. This is Joseph, the father of Jesus, whose greatest virtue is his patience. Here is a man who discovers that his fiancée, Mary, is pregnant, and not only accepts the explanation that God was responsible, he raises the child as his own. We never hear Joseph speak in the Gospels. Instead, he is given a series of assurances or commands from God: take Mary as your wife, take your family to Egypt, and he wordlessly obeys. I suspect that some of the online influencers who promote a return to traditional rugged masculinity might regard Joseph as the ultimate cuckold, devoid of self-respect, barely a man. How wrong they'd be. Joseph's silence doesn't denote a lack of thought, we're told, that he considered divorce, but a confident faith. To quote Pope Benedict, he said a silent but echoing yes to God. And by so doing, he said yes to his wife, to a baby, and to responsibility. Such accumulated duties are, like wrinkles and grey hair, proof that we have lived. I am convinced that gender is not defined solely by what we are, our biology, but what we do. And this is what gives femininity or masculinity its moral quality. When someone says man up, they typically mean the very opposite of juvenile or sexist or toxic behaviour. They mean be strong so that you can be a rock for others. Be courageous so you can dare to do the right thing. In my Catholic tradition, most ministers are called to celibacy and so cannot have children. Yet we call priests father just as monks are brothers. And when we speak of a brotherhood of man, this is not to exclude our sisters, of course, but to extend the definition of family to the whole of humanity. Insofar as it is a project to love others, being a man is truly an international endeavour.
That was Thought for the Day with the Catholic commentator and writer for the Daily Telegraph, Tim Stanley. Time now is 10 to 8.
First, he promised during his election campaign he would release the so-called Epstein files from the investigation into the late sex offender and paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. But then Donald Trump, as president, has spent his time in office blocking all attempts to release these files, angering many amongst his base. And now American politicians have paved the way for the Justice Department to release these files, marking a major U-turn for an increasingly agitated Donald Trump over the issue. His agitation boiling over with two particular female journalists in recent days asking questions on the matter, one of whom he told to be quiet and called her piggy. Something our North America editor Sarah Smith will reflect on in just a moment. But first, let's hear from Lisa Bloom, who has represented 11 of Jeffrey Epstein's victims and survivors and long called for the release of these files. I started by asking her when we might actually see them.
Probably within the next couple of days. There's just a few technicalities. I mean, it has to be physically taken to the Senate. The Senate has already said that they would vote to release the files. And President Trump has said he will sign it as soon as it gets to him.
From your perspective, I mean, how major could this be? Because this, you know, for those who haven't followed this story, the pressure to release this has been huge from some. And I mean, you know, for others, it will be intriguing. But they, you know, I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, how big this could be.
Well, we think this is big because we know the scale of Jeffrey Epstein's predations is hundreds, maybe over 1,000 girls, right? You cannot molest that many girls all by yourself. You have to have help. We know that Ghislaine Maxwell, who's currently in prison, helped him. But there were probably many, many others. He had friends at the highest levels, as you know, royals, people who were president in the U.S. or became president, very wealthy and powerful people. We want to know who they are and what they knew, when they knew it, and did they help him in his criminal enterprise?
And are you expecting new names we've not heard before, potentially?
I am expecting new names, and I look forward to seeing who they are. Now, listen, everybody who crossed paths with Jeffrey Epstein or went to a party with him obviously is not guilty of sex trafficking. But these private emails, private text messages, audio and video, I think are going to be very revealing about the level of complicity with Jeffrey Epstein.
And what do you read into Donald Trump's change of position? You know, going from this is a Democrat hoax to, you know, release the files.
Well, you know, Donald Trump came to the right conclusion after exhausting every other possible option, right? He only a few days ago was calling Republicans traitors who were going to vote for the release of the files. Then he realized that he was on the wrong end of this, that the American public was clamoring for the release of the files, that people actually care about sexual abuse, not as a political issue, but because they care about girls and women. And he had to change course. And that's what he did.
That's Lisa Bloom. The attorney has represented 11 of Epstein's victims. Sarah Smith is our North America editor. I started by asking her about that U-turn from President Trump on releasing the Epstein files.
It's clear he doesn't want to do this because he could have done it at any point. But the political pressure is such that every single day he is being asked about the Epstein files. And he's made his frustration clear in social media posts by saying people are not focusing on what he says are the successes of his administration because they're constantly harping on these Epstein files. And so he's obviously decided that in order to be able to concentrate on anything else, he simply has to agree to release these files.
Just on that infuriation, a clip that was very widely circulated yesterday was him getting extremely annoyed, as it seemed, on Friday when a journalist from Bloomberg asked a question about the release of these files. And he seemed to say, quiet piggy, to her.
Yeah. On Air Force One, the journalist asked the same question that many have been doing for the last few days about, are you going to release the Epstein files? And he got, you could see he was absolutely enraged as he said, quiet, quiet piggy. To her because he was so angry about the Epstein files being brought up again. And actually, yesterday in the Oval Office, when he was there with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, he got equally angry with another journalist asking him about the Epstein files and said that she was a terrible person and a terrible reporter, both female journalists, notably. But the level of his anger about being constantly asked about this has become very visible in these outbursts against journalists who've been asking him these questions. And it was going to grow and grow as a political issue, but now he is faced with having to actually sign this piece of legislation that will make the Justice Department release the files and maybe put to bed the suspicion that he was refusing to do so because he was protecting friends or donors or other rich and powerful men. It could be that in 30 days' time, we will finally see what's in these files and what was causing such a political problem for him.
Well, it could be even quicker, according to what Lisa Bloom was just saying. But let's see. And I suppose there's also the question of whether, you know, people are very interested if there's a risk to him, if there's more content that mentions Donald Trump. Well, we'll, of course, have to wait to see on that. But just in terms of a final word on that agitation and the way he's speaking and has been noted specifically to female reporters. I mean, he's been very rude to male reporters that he's seen as biased against him as well. But there is this concern, Sarah, and I ask you in your position as our North America editor and as a woman, I mean, saying quiet piggy to a woman, what is the response to that in America?
Well, everything in America, as you know, Emma, is extremely polarized. So on one side of the political debate, people are absolutely infuriated. And on the other, people are angry that somebody had the temerity to ask Donald Trump about the Epstein files. So you will never find consensus, I'm afraid, in this country over anything to do with Donald Trump. But yeah, there is considerable disquiet about the way he's been lashing out at journalists. Female journalists asking him these questions. And I suspect that that is one of the reasons why he has decided to do a vault fast on this issue, because ultimately that kind of thing was going to do him pretty deep political damage if he was going to continue with these angry outbursts. And it was ultimately distracting from the rest of his agenda. And that's probably why he's given in to the pressure to finally release the files.
Sarah Smith, our North America editor, thank you.
It is 8:03. Let's look ahead to next week on Radio 4.
From the ceremonial sword of state to the humble ballot box, what stories do certain objects tell us about the way our public life is conducted?
I think it's important that the history is understood and the contexts are understood.
For many, they serve as powerful reminders of tradition and continuity. Yet for others, they represent division and narratives that demand scrutiny and re-evaluation.
That really brought home to me the power of an image.
Materials of State with me, David Cannadine, begins next Monday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And to the weather with Simon King.
Amol, thanks so much indeed. Yeah, we've got a real mixture of rain, sleet and snow out there this morning. For Wales, the Midlands, eastern and southern areas of England, this area of rain, sleet and snow is continuing to move southward. Eventually it's going to clear away. But this morning, some of us have woken up to a little bit of snow, even down to some relatively low levels, but most of it has been over the higher ground of Wales so far this morning. But for Wales and southwest England, in the far west, there'll be some further showers, which could be wintry over higher ground. And for eastern and southeastern areas of England, it'll stay fairly cloudy. Still a few showers coming into the Wash and East Anglia. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 3 to 7 degrees. But it's across parts of northeast England, eastern and northeast Scotland, where we have got some frequent snow showers moving in. This is giving us more significant snowfall, even down to low levels, but as much as 25 centimetres is possible over higher ground. There is an amber warning from the Met Office valid for tomorrow. It's just the accumulative effect of all the snow piling up through today and overnight into tomorrow morning that could cause some significant disruption. Away from the snow showers, there'll be some sunny spells. And then elsewhere across Scotland, northwest England, it's looking largely dry. There'll be some sunshine today. And for Northern Ireland today, there'll be some scattered showers, some of those a bit wintry over higher ground, a few sunny spells. A brisk northerly wind for all of us across the UK. So temperatures about freezing to 7 degrees Celsius. It will feel colder when you're in the wind.
It will indeed. You're listening to Today. Thanks, Simon, on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett.
It's 8:00 on Wednesday, the 19th of November. The headlines this morning. For the first time in nearly three decades, Scotland's men are heading to the Football World Cup finals after a dramatic win against Denmark. Inflation has dipped slightly to its lowest rate for 4 months in the last set of figures to be released before the budget. And the US Congress has passed a law to try to force the Justice Department to release files on the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
Also coming up on the programme, the Princess of Wales has called on business leaders to prioritise time and tenderness.
Love is the first and most essential bond, but it's also the invisible thread woven with time, attention and tenderness through consistent nurturing relationships, which creates the grounded and meaningful environments around a child.
We'll hear from the professor who's been working with the princess on how we can all bring some more love into our lives and our children's lives and a lot more attention to actually be in the moment. And new research suggests Neanderthals and early humans kissed each other. That's right, we've all had nights out we regret. We'll have all of the romance of that research after 8:30. Can't wait. The news, though, first is read by Lisa Costello.
Scotland's men have qualified for the Football World Cup for the first time since 1998 with a dramatic 4-2 win over Denmark in injury time at Hampden Park in Glasgow. Steve Clarke's side needed a win to ensure a place in the tournament, but they twice lost the lead before making a decisive breakthrough to turn around their World Cup fortunes. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss was watching the match at Hampden Park.
An unforgettable finish to a quite unforgettable night as Scotland ended their long World Cup wait in barely believable fashion. Needing to beat Denmark to qualify, their hopes seemed over with a score 2-2 going into injury time.
But it's fallen to Tierney!
But Kieran Tierney fired them ahead before, from the halfway line, Kenny McLean sealed their qualification in sensational style.
He's knocked it from the halfway line. It's over Schmeichel. What a goal from Kenny McLean!
Scotland's captain Andy Robertson said the win was a testament to his team's resilience.
That just sums up this squad. Never say die. We just keep going right to the end. And one of the craziest games of football. We've certainly put the country through it. I'm sure it'll be all worth it.
It's certainly been some roller coaster for Scotland. They had toiled in recent matches, losing to Greece at the weekend. But they rose to the occasion at the perfect time. And after 28 years of heartache, finally, gloriously, the World Cup beckons.
Wales are still in contention to qualify for the tournament after thrashing North Macedonia in Cardiff. Their 7-1 win ensures they'll play their World Cup semi-final playoff at home. Figures released in the past hour show that the rate of inflation slowed to 3.6% in the year to October, the lowest level for 4 months. That's down from 3.8% in September. It's the last set of figures before the budget next week. More details from our business reporter, Ben King.
The main contributor to the lower inflation rate was a slower increase in domestic energy bills compared with last October, driven by a smaller rise in the Ofgem price cap. A slower increase in airfares was also a factor, partly offset by the rising cost of petrol and diesel. The price of hotels also fell. The cost of food rose 4.9% as retailers passed on their increased cost to consumers, according to the ONS's chief economist, Grant Fitzner.
A lot of the increases in costs in raw materials, for example, and energy over the last couple of years were not passed through to consumers. Now that headline inflation has come down, we're seeing some attempt, it would appear, to kind of rebuild some of those margins, but that's quite gradual.
Falling inflation will strengthen the case for the Bank of England to cut interest rates in December. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, welcomed the fall, but said she was determined to do more to bring prices down.
Both chambers of Congress have voted to force the Justice Department to publish files from the investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. After making a U-turn on the issue, President Trump now says he'll sign the bill into law as soon as he gets it. He had previously described the campaign to release files as a Democrat-led hoax. From Washington, here's our North America editor, Sarah Smith.
For months, Donald Trump has resisted calls to release the Epstein files, even as many of his own supporters have been clamouring for him to make the information public. Now the bill has been passed by Congress, he will have to decide shortly whether or not to sign it into law. He said he is prepared to do so, but if he really wanted to, he could have published the files without congressional approval. President Trump has grown obviously frustrated at the constant attention on Epstein. In a social media post, he said he didn't want Republicans to take their eyes off all the victories he says they've had, referencing immigration and the economy. If he signs the legislation, the Justice Department will have 30 days to release the files, which campaigners believe will reveal the names of rich and powerful men who participated in the abuse of many of Epstein's victims.
Ukraine says Russia's overnight bombardment has killed 9 people. President Zelensky says Moscow launched more than 470 drones and 48 missiles. The head of Estonia's navy has warned about a rising number of ships bound for Russia, which may be trying to evade sanctions imposed because of the Ukraine war. He said they were sailing without a valid flag and many were aging oil tankers, which were in danger of causing a big oil spill. Here's our Europe correspondent Jessica Parker.
This is all linked to the shadow fleet, a term that commonly refers to hundreds of tankers used by Russia to bypass Western sanctions on oil exports imposed after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And now there's a new trend. The chief of the Estonian Navy told me that this year they've seen a growing number of vessels sailing without a valid flag. That matches with a broader global spike recorded by maritime authorities as sanctions have intensified. One analyst compared many shadow ships to floating rust buckets and warned that it would be impossible to find someone responsible to pick up the cost if a stateless vessel suffered a catastrophic oil spill. Moscow's embassy in London told the BBC that it's politically motivated anti-Russian sanctions that have heightened the risks.
A British woman and four other tourists have died after becoming caught in a snowstorm in Chile. The Chilean authorities say the group became lost on a hiking circuit in one of the country's most famous national parks, Torres del Paine. They faced blizzard conditions and wind speeds of more than 100 miles an hour. A man freed after being jailed for 38 years in one of the UK's longest miscarriages of justice has told the BBC he was bullied into falsely confessing to the murder of a 21-year-old woman on Merseyside. Peter Sullivan was speaking in his first interview since his release 6 months ago. He was cleared after new DNA evidence proved he wasn't the killer. Phil McCann has the details. In the report, Mr. Sullivan's voice has been disguised to protect his identity.
Peter Sullivan wasn't allowed access to a solicitor when he confessed in an unrecorded interview to sexually attacking and murdering Diane Sindall in Birkenhead in 1986. Now he's told the BBC he was beaten up in police custody, and officers threatened to link him to a series of rapes he hadn't committed if he didn't confess. Merseyside Police says it has no details of those allegations. Mr. Sullivan says he now wants an explanation and an apology.
I can't carry on with my life if I can't get an answer of them. That's all I want, is an apology and the reason why they've done this to me.
The force says it regrets that there's been a grave miscarriage of justice in this case. Its investigation into the murder is ongoing.
The chief executive of WH Smith, Carl Cowling, has resigned after an investigation into accounting errors at its North American division. A review found a series of shortcomings which saw the firm overstate the profits of its US business by as much as £50 million. Figures obtained by the BBC show the number of days taken to deal with shoplifting cases in England and Wales has risen by more than 80% in the past decade. Retailers have described the rise as unacceptable. Jim Connolly has the story.
Official figures show the average time taken to process a shoplifter from offence to being dealt with at a magistrates' court in England and Wales rose from 32 days in 2014 to 59 days last year. One case we followed took 10 months. The government told us it knew that many cases were taking too long to be resolved. It said it was back in courts with record funding. The National Police Chiefs Council said it had made significant strides in the fight against retail crime and worked closely with retailers.
Scientists have traced the origins of kissing, which they say evolved more than 21 million years ago. Researchers examined evidence of the different species of primates that kiss each other to reach their findings. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has more on this romantic tale.
Humans do it, chimpanzees do it, even polar bears do it. And now a study has shown that kissing likely evolved about 21.5 million years ago. The mouth-on-mouth kiss is actually something of a biological puzzle with no obvious survival or reproductive benefits. So the Oxford University-led team gathered evidence of animals that kiss each other on the mouth and worked out their evolutionary relationship to each other and to humans. This revealed that kissing probably evolved in the last common ape ancestor of humans, chimps and bonobos. The study suggested that Neanderthals probably kissed too and that they may have smooched with modern humans when the two species lived alongside each other. The researchers hope that the insight will encourage more scientists to gather data that could finally help solve the evolutionary mystery of why we and many other animals kiss.
That's our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
Lisa, thank you so much. It is 8:10. The budget is a week today. As Labour leader and then Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer said countless times that growth was a key mission of this Labour government.
I said before the election, and I say it again really clearly today, growth, and frankly by that I do mean wealth creation, is the number one priority of this Labour government.
I want to take our country forward, and the only way to do that is to have a comprehensive plan for growth.
As we target the highest sustained growth in the G7. So working people have more money in their pocket.
But in the run-up to next week's budget, most of the noise has been not about growth, but taxes. And lest anyone blame we pesky hacks for that, a gentle reminder that once upon a time, chancellors said nothing before budgets because of Purdah. But week before last, Rachel Reeves held an unusual 8 a.m. press conference, laying the ground for tax rises, some of which may now have been dropped. Is there a relationship between taxation and growth? And if so, what is it? There are some who think you can and should both grow the economy and increase fairness by taxing the very rich, particularly their assets. Here's Zach Polansky, the leader of the Green Party, on last night's Today debate on Radio 4, which asked the question, who should pay more tax?
We need to have a conversation in this country about inequality. The 50 wealthiest families own more wealth than the bottom 50% of the population combined. That's 35 million people compared to 50 families. Yet we have a government that is always talking about tough choices. Why are they always tough choices for working class people, for unemployed people, for disabled people? It's time to make tough choices for multimillionaires and billionaires. It is time to tax the rich.
Zach Polansky. Well, others say that asking the rich to pay ever more can in some cases be unfair, depending on how they've earned that money, and can be ineffective because they will leave the country and take their taxes and investment with them. Here's former Conservative Chancellor Sir Jeremy Hunt also speaking on last night's debate about the tension that he thinks exists between tax rises and economic growth.
If all you care about is equality at all costs, you don't care if it drives investors abroad, you don't care if it means fewer jobs, then yes, tax rich people out of existence. But if you care about economic growth, if you want more money to go into the NHS, the schools, the police, our public services, then growth is the priority. And that means avoiding tax rises because they slow down economic growth.
Plenty of people in the private sector argue that small and medium-sized businesses are the backbone of the economy and often operate with very tight margins. Small fluctuations in their costs, including tax rises, can be the difference between their being viable or not. In September, at Chester Races, Nick spoke to one such business owner, John Walsh, who runs the gut health company Bio and Me, about the trade-offs that his company faces.
So we've got 15 people. The national insurance extra we're paying this year is £39,000. So that's one person we can't hire because we're paying that. The packaging, we're paying about £120,000. That's kind of two, maybe three jobs. And then inflation is £400,000 more this year than last year. So if that would just been halved, maybe we could have hired four more people. And I honestly think if people could vote, they'd rather I hired five more people here in Chester rather than paid more tax. So we want to do our bit, but I'd like to do it through creating jobs rather than paying more tax.
Most economists would argue that whether tax changes help or hinder growth depends on who you tax, which taxes you adjust, and by how much. They'd also mostly agree that the more you depend on lots of changes to smaller taxes, the more important it is to reform those taxes so that they are fairer and less damaging to growth. How should we think about the trade-offs between taxes and growth in Whitehall and beyond? Well, Sam White was Chief of Staff to Keir Starmer between 2021 and 2022. Before that, he was a Special Advisor in the Treasury under the Labour Chancellor Alasdair Darling. He's now a Specialist Partner at Flint Global. And Lord Rose, Stuart Rose, is a Conservative peer, former Chair of ASDA, Ocado and Marks & Spencer, and both join us now. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sam, if I could start with you, how do you think broadly, what is the connection between taxation and growth, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an interplay between taxation, government spending and growth. And I don't think it's as simple as all taxes lead to lower growth. I think that misunderstands what public spending often does to improve the growth rate in the economy. For example, investing in a productive infrastructure like transport or energy or digital sometimes and housing. But there's also huge costs to growth by not spending money. I think the DWP Work and Pensions report, I think, of this year said there's something like £300 billion cost to the economy every year of ill health. And, you know, you can argue that failing to have an adequate funding of NHS and increasing waiting lists contributes to that sort of drag on the economy. So it's not quite as simple as, you know, government spending and tax drags down growth. But I think the government does need to be very careful in considering the budget measures that they don't do things that drag growth. And there are certainly things that could contribute to inflation, like, say, VAT rises.
So, Stuart, how do you think, in broad terms, before we get into specifics, how do you think about the connection between taxes and growth?
Well, it's an unproven academic argument that's been going on for decades, and there's no right answer to it, but it's certainly unproven. I'd like to remind you about what I think it was Winston Churchill said, that, you know, raising taxes to encourage growth is like standing in a bucket and lifting it up by the handle. It doesn't work.
If you want to cut taxes, Sir Stuart, where do you think the government or a society, all of us, could get the most bang for our buck? That is, how could you optimise the growth upside that flows from any cut in taxation?
Well, just start in a slightly different place, Amal. Listen, we all know, we only know one form of creating wealth, and that's through capitalism. And, you know, it's got its good bits and its bad bits. But only business creates wealth. And we need to create an environment in this country at the moment where we nurture people, we encourage them, we reward effort, and we say to them that when you've put in this effort and you've created this wealth, there's going to be something for you and something for us. And at the moment, it's in an imbalance. We don't have a clear view, and people are frightened. And if you talk to people in business, and I do a lot, and you talk to people in the street, they're fearful, they're demotivated, they're anxious, and they're certainly very anxious now about what's going to happen next week.
So can I ask you a specific question then, Sir Stuart? If you want to address that imbalance, as you put it, what would you like to see, specific measures in the budget next week that address that imbalance?
Well, I won't answer directly, but first thing to say is, look, I would be perfectly happy to pay more tax. Right? I'm perfectly happy, provided that that tax is used in a way that everybody and I understand is going to the good, whether it's in education, whether it's in encouraging investment, whether it's about whether it's about other initiatives that stimulate growth. But what I can't understand and I can't reconcile is the fact that the government, on the other hand, won't recognize the elephant in the room, which is the fact that we are now living above our means, and we have got costs, whether it's costs in welfare, whether it's the triple lock, whether it's other services, whether it's the size of the civil service, whether it's the number of 3 million people that we've got who are not looking for work and aren't working. It's unsustainable. So they've got to do their bit, which is to say, we will cut our costs, and at the same time, we'll take a bit off you. But it's got to be a balance. It's got to be a quid pro quo.
Sam, just take us inside the room, because you've actually been there, Sam, when chancellors are thinking about this, and you've been offering advice in that moment. If you have to raise taxes, Stuart says he's happy to pay more tax if you can get value for money. If you have to raise taxes, Sam, which should you raise and by how much in order to mitigate any negative impact on growth?
I mean, to Stuart's kind of core point, which is, you know, wealth is created by capitalism and business. I agree. And this is why I part company with people like Zach Blansky saying, you know, let's hammer the rich and if they leave the country, so be it. I think that is a mistake. I think you do have to pay attention to how you raise your taxes. I remember sitting in the Treasury, you know, with Alistair Darling in the, you know, post-global financial crisis days, where the upshot of that had been a big increase in government spending to see off a second Great Depression, and it left a deficit. And discussing which of the taxes there and the spending cuts you could make that would have the best impact on continuing growth without doing any harm to it. So, you know, we were looking at where were the multiplier effects of government spending, either because the economy was flat and needed a fiscal stimulus, or because we knew we'd get better returns on them, such as, you know, transport investment, which often returns, you know, £1.50 for every pound spent. So it's a good growth measure. You do need to think very carefully about whether a number of small changes end up hitting a lot of people. I've often been a fan of taking a big rise in one of the main taxes above lots of small measures. And that's how I would instinctively approach this. There's plenty of opportunity to reform the tax system to make it more effective as well. There's an awful lot of oddities like VAT. If I'm eating a biscuit right now, you know, it's not paying VAT, but if I'm eating a cake, it is VAT. Perhaps it's the opposite. Who can remember? There's plenty of things that might make the system simpler.
So there's a case for reform as well. Can I ask you, Sam, before I return to Sir Stuart for a final thought, to what extent would you agree, Sam, with William Hague's assessment this week? He's obviously a former Conservative leader, but his assessment this week that this has been, and I quote, the most disastrous preparation for a budget in modern political history.
Yeah, I mean, I'd obviously reject that. This is the government that brought us a Liz Truss mini-budget. But more importantly, there was only two really big strategic decisions.
No, you're talking about preparation for a budget. Like Rachel Reeves giving a speech where she seems to, and then her team briefing that this might indicate a rise in income tax, and then shortly afterwards it's leaking out from somewhere that actually that income tax rise isn't going to happen.
But this is part of the problem with the way we approach questions of growth. You know, we concentrate on a froth of who said what on what day in the short term, whereas actually what's interesting is how do we get where we are and what are our prospects for growth based on the decisions taken over the last 10, 15 years. And the failure to invest in infrastructure when money was cheap under the Osborne years and Farage's big idea of Brexit are the two big decisions that define where we are today. And in many ways, the mess we have is the economic love child of George Osborne and Nigel Farage, which has been dumped unceremoniously on a doorstep of Downing Street for this Prime Minister and Chancellor to try and raise while they gallivant off into the night giggling and taking no responsibility for their actions. Sure. So I think you do have to look at the real...
I'm sure they wouldn't say they were gallivanting into the night or giggling. Let me, if I could put a final thought to you, Sir Stuart, you mentioned the long-term outlook. Do you think we talk enough, just to go back to Sam's point, Sir Stuart, about whether or not, do you think we talk enough about the fundamentals? I mean, we are, next week there might be 2p here or 2p off tax here or there. But if you look at the OBR's economic and fiscal outlook for, you know, decades hence, and I was doing that at 2 o'clock this morning, it essentially describes a country that's going bust pretty quickly. You know, you cut through the euphemism, you cut through the jargon, it says that on current trends by 2070, just over a generation away, debt will be 270% of GDP. Do you think we're talking enough about that underlying situation?
Often, if I recollect, that was part of the argument that William Hague had in his article yesterday, which I totally agree with. We do have to plan for the long term. Governments can't just plan the next 4 years just to keep everybody sweet to get the vote again at the next general election. The electorate are not stupid. If you tell them what the problem is, explain to them what the medicine they need to take is, and tell them that it will take a certain amount of time to get this right, but know and give them confidence that they, their children and their grandchildren will have a better future. They will listen, and I think they will understand. And I think it's shambolic what we've got at the moment. I mean, we're running a business, we're running a country now, an economy now, where it's run by opinion poll and it's run by focus groups. It's nonsense.
Lord Rose and Sam White, thank you both very much indeed.
23 minutes past 8. Have you had your breakfast yet? What was in it? Was it good? What's the definition? Earlier in the programme, we spoke to Professor Chris van Tulleken, author of the book Ultra-Processed People, about his major new paper in The Lancet, with others arguing ultra-processed foods are linked to multiple chronic diseases, a pandemic of chronic diseases. But if that's true, and there's certainly a lot of evidence in there, and it's peer-reviewed, and if ultra-processed foods really are everywhere, can you avoid them without spending much more money or time? How do you educate yourself on what you eat? There's no one definition of ultra-processed foods, but some describe them as foods that contain ingredients you will not find in your kitchen cupboard. For example, if you see an additive or an emulsifier or a stabiliser in the ingredients, it's likely to be ultra-processed. That's according to the Food Standards Agency. Start thinking perhaps about what you do eat, what you don't eat, what you might need to eat a bit more of, but we've got help on hand. Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall, celebrity chef, TV personality, journalist and, of course, campaigner on food and environmental issues, as well as Charlotte Sterling-Reed, baby and child nutritionist, on the line. Warm welcome. Good morning to you both. Hugh, just on that, how do you change perhaps what's in your cupboard? Where would you start?
Well, this is a tricky one. Amol just asked Lord Rose, do we talk enough about the fundamentals? There's nothing more fundamental than how we feed ourselves and our kids. But in a sense, your question has framed it, as it's so often being framed, as a sense of personal responsibility for individuals doing their shopping and making their food choices. And that, as Chris van Tulleken pointed out earlier, is to kind of miss the point. We do have to somehow find ways to help people understand that whole unprocessed foods, especially fresh vegetables and fruit, are an incredible life force that can keep us all well. Unfortunately, we're eating the opposite of that, UPFs. They're seriously harmful and they're making us ill. So I would say we've got to start by feeding our kids better food at school. It's an amazing opportunity to put real nutritious food in front of our children every single day and shift the food culture, not constantly putting it back on what are you going to cook tonight, what are you going to choose in the supermarket.
I accept that, but there are levels of knowledge about this which are important to try and share while we're in it. You know, a whole generation's life can pass by while the food culture isn't shifted.
Absolutely.
And, you know,
I agree,
and the ingredients,
we can't delay that process of education any longer. And I could, you know, of course I've got some ideas for healthier eating. If you can cook a good tomato sauce, you can put all sorts of great inexpensive ingredients in it, including tins of beans. You can spice it up. You can eat porridge for breakfast instead of sugar-sweetened cereals. But you know what? We've been saying these things for decades.
It's true.
We need policy action from the government that takes this fundamental issue of a diet that is killing the nation, that is causing huge backlogs in the NHS. And I don't really want to come on the show and just toss in a few recipe ideas when we've got such a fundamental problem to deal with that has not been addressed by successive governments. There were some vaguely encouraging noises from Keir Starmer last week when he said he'd review school food, but they were completely drowned out by the obsession of the Labour Party eating itself, which is not a very healthy thing.
A healthy
to
diet,
doing
when
they,
you may say. Charlotte,
helping us find better food.
Let me come back to that. And Hugh, I completely accept that point. We've done a great deal on the programme to talk about the policy side of things and what has stagnated and not changed, and also the food industry and its response to what it is and what it isn't doing. And we will continue to do that. It's also what one can do. Try to do now to learn and to make some meaningful changes. And even just, I suppose, Charlotte, looking at what is on labels, and especially we've also focused on baby food and food that comes in pouches. What is your response this morning when we have this new paper out?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with a lot of what Hugh said. The only thing I would add to that, though, is first of all, education alone is not enough. We can't just educate. There has to be an environmental shift. There has to be a change in this. And I'd go one further than Hugh as well and say that nurseries are key, and not just nurseries. When pregnant women are having babies and are not given any information about how to feed them, what foods to start with, they're turning to advice from the food industry and what's on the supermarket aisles. And what we need to do is have in place a support system and a structure that seriously helps parents and new mums to learn about eating, not just via education, but via, yes, changing food labels, changing the food system, and certainly by changing what is being offered to young children at nurseries and at schools. It's absolutely vital. And that, along with education and along with changing the food system, is going to have the biggest impact. But we have to start right at the very beginning with young children, because we know that their diets track into adulthood.
And how would that start?
Well, for example, I think, you know, there's very little services at the moment, health visitors, midwives, to support parents. That's actually been brought back by about 30%. Parents are at a time in their lives when they're more likely to accept new knowledge and education. And also they are at a time where it's very confusing. They're baffled about what foods they should and shouldn't be feeding. And instead of just having the media constantly shame them for their choices, what we have to do is help and support them with making the right decisions in the first place. If young children get good diets with variety, with balance, that will track into older children and into adulthood. And if we're not starting at that very young age, we're missing a whole new generation of children who can actually improve their long life diet.
Hugh, as someone who has a 2-year-old, a 7-year-old, obviously, you know, a job, a partner with a job, you know, a lot is out there around snack culture and, you know, how we eat on the go. And when you actually try and, as I have done for health reasons, try and reduce inflammation and cut out ultra processed foods as much as possible, it's actually really impossible walking around the streets of Britain, isn't it? If you're out on the go to get a lot of food that is not UPF. That's the point, isn't it?
It is extremely hard. I'd just also like to say that I wholeheartedly agree with your other interviewee. The younger we start, the better. And showing kids food that is real rather than opening a jar and spooning some mush into them, without even in the early years necessarily insisting that they eat it. But it's about that recognition of what real food actually looks like. So if they can see you preparing food in the kitchen, if you give them just a carrot to play with or a slice of apple to nibble if they want to. But we need to raise a generation, and this is absolutely right, from the youngest possible years, to recognise real food.
Are you optimistic, Hugh, that we'll get there with this food culture as it has gone?
Well, it can be done. Other countries are doing much better than we are. I mean, at the other end of the spectrum, we see countries having some success putting serious health warning labels on the most dangerous UPFs. Those are the kind of labels that manufacturers and brands don't want on their products. And it's also an incentive to reformulate them and make them healthier.
Hugh, we're gonna have to leave it there.
There are a lot of different levers that need to be pulled, and we need to pull them all.
Hugh Fearnley-Whittingstall, Charlotte Sterling-Reed, thank you.
8:30, time to pull the Mike Williams lever. How are you, Mike?
Thank you, Amol. Well, I dare say there may be a few sore heads across Scotland this morning. It's not quite a national holiday across the nation, but it might as well be after an unforgettable night last night at Hampden.
You have just witnessed history. Scotland are going back to the World Cup, but just look what it means to them. A moment in time, a moment to treasure, a moment that many of us thought would never be seen again. Scotland confirmed their return to the greatest show on earth.
Yes, an unforgettable 4-2 victory over Denmark last night at Hampden has taken Scotland back to the World Cup, ending nearly three decades of hurt in the process. Let's get some reflections on what was an incredible night with former Scotland defender Colin Calderwood, played for Scotland at the last World Cup they reached back in 1998. Morning, Colin.
Good morning.
And the former Scotland manager Craig Levine is also with us. Hi, Craig.
Good morning, mate.
Colin, let's start with you. Those Scotland players and coaching staff partying like it's 1998, I'm sure, this morning. Scotland finally back at a men's World Cup. How does that feel?
Well, I mean, it was tremendously exciting, wasn't it? And the sort of drama of the game and the way it unfolded was, it's almost like a film story. So absolutely delighted for the boys. Trying to remember how we felt in that moment, but it's just sheer delight. And relief to a certain degree as well, but it's very emotional as well when you see parents, family, friends in the stand. It sort of gets right to the centre of you, and I think you saw that in some of the interviews after the game with Andy Robertson and John McGinn.
And Craig, a word on Steve Clarke, the man who was one of many to follow in your footsteps as Scotland manager. He has done something no one has ever done and taken Scotland now to three major tournaments.
Yeah, it has been a bit of a roller coaster, Mike, but I'll tell you what, that was worth it. But to see what we saw last night, what an absolutely brilliant game of football. It's what football's all about, the highs and the lows. It was a real roller coaster. And the emotions that I think every Scotsman felt last night were real and intense.
Absolutely. And what about those goals, Colin? We said to Pat Nevin earlier, contender really for three of the best Scotland goals ever, all in the one match.
Yeah, I mean, sort of goal of the season in one game and almost in one half. It's sort of typified the game, really. It was that sort of, we're off to a Hollywood area for the World Cup finals, but it was like a Hollywood story, as I mentioned before. But it's also the resolution of the team and the grit of them to, especially when it went to 2-2, to see that game out. And on the other side of it, you've got the emotion of the guy who gets sent off for Denmark, who'll be sat in the dressing room listening to the roars of the crowd. And he must be in a terrible place. But unfortunately, we don't worry too much about him at the minute. But we've had enough of our moments in that case.
Well, exactly, Craig. As Colin touched on there, this has been two decades, hasn't it, of disappointment. More than almost three decades, really, when it comes to World Cups. Take the point that Scotland have been to back-to-back Euros, but the World Cup is much bigger. And this just does breathe new life into this generation of Scotland football players who have for so long been told about the glories of the 70s and the 80s. Now they're writing their own history.
Yeah, and also the fans as well. There's a lot of fans who have never been to the World Cup, especially the younger ones. It's a wonderful thing for everybody in Scotland this morning and waking up knowing that the team are going to the World Cup. And I mentioned Steve last night. He puts his subs on and three of his subs score a goal. I mean, it's a dream night for him, isn't it? Mm. You know, and it's really unusual for something like that to happen.
Just briefly from both of you, in a sentence, got to ask you, what can they do at the tournament next year? We'll find out the draw on the 5th of December, who they're going to face, where they're going to play. They've never got out of a group at a major tournament, have they, Scotland? Colin, can you see Scotland doing that next year in North America?
Well, it's absolutely guaranteed. The hooker by crook will do it, and I remember Scotland qualifying in England, not in the 70s, so anything's possible.
And Craig, do you share that optimism?
Very much so. Yeah, I think it's that the group of players that we've got are the best I've had for quite a while. And I'm very optimistic.
Well, we shall see. We'll be talking lots about Scotland between now and the World Cup next June. Gentlemen, many thanks. Former Scotland manager Craig Levine there and former defender Colin Calderwood live on the programme. Need to mention Wales. Any other morning, they will be the lead story. A 7-1 victory over North Macedonia last night means that they will get a home semi-final in the playoffs back in March. They'll find out their opponents tomorrow in the draw. And away from football, in cricket, England have in the last hour named off-spinner Shoaib Bashir in a 12-man squad alongside five pace bowlers for the first Ashes test, which, remember, starts on Friday. Mark Wood has been past fit as well, so he seems fit to play against Australia in Perth in the early hours of Friday morning.
Mike, thank you for all of the joy this morning. Here's Sean Williams to tell us about this morning's upcoming life-changing episode.
Hello. My guest this morning has a passion that not everyone will understand. He loves crawling through tunnels and caves, hundreds of feet below the earth, in the dark and the wet, an underground world which very few of us get to see, or would want to, perhaps. But one day, George Linnane went with a couple of mates to the deepest cave in Britain, intending to spend a few hours there. He fell, starting one of the longest and most complex rescues in caving history. Life-changing. After the news at 9.
Quick look at the weather. Windy and cold today, with wintry showers moving in from the north. Drier with sunny spells inland. Maybe sunny spills too.
We'll take those. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Emma Barnett. It's 23 minutes to 9, and now a summary of the news with Lisa Costello.
Scotland's men have qualified for the Football World Cup for the first time since 1998 with a dramatic 4-2 win over Denmark in injury time at Hampden Park in Glasgow. The captain, Andy Robertson, said the match showed his team's never-say-die attitude. The UK inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, eased to 3.6% in the year to October, the lowest the rate has been for 4 months. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, welcomed the drop but vowed more targeted action to bring down inflation in next week's budget. President Zelensky says 9 people have been killed in a Russian strike on the Ukrainian city of Ternopil. An overnight attack involving hundreds of drones and more than 40 missiles targeted cities and towns in the west of the country. Both chambers of Congress have voted to force the Justice Department to publish files from the investigation into the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. After making a U-turn on the issue, President Trump now says he'll sign the bill into law as soon as he gets it.
Lisa, thank you. It's 22 minutes to 9. The Princess of Wales has used her first public speech since her cancer treatment to call on business leaders to prioritise time, tenderness and love amid the pursuit of profit and success. She was talking at the Future Workforce Summit, in which business leaders were urged to help employees balance their family life and work existence, as well as highlighting the role businesses can play in supporting the early years of our children's lives. She emphasised her belief that the love felt during those years shapes who we become as adults.
Love is the first and most essential bond, but it's also the invisible thread woven with time, attention and tenderness through consistent nurturing relationships, which creates the grounded and meaningful environments around a child.
Also speaking at the same summit, Professor Robert Waldinger, who has been doing some work with the Princess. He's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and he's director of the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which is one of the longest running studies of adult life conducted. Good morning.
Good morning.
Love to business leaders, to talking to them about that. How did that go down?
It actually went down surprisingly well.
Because to your face.
Yes. Because, well, but I think everyone is quite concerned about the absence of love, and particularly the absence of human connection, as we're more divided from each other, as we're more locked into our screens and turn away from each other.
And I want to hear more about what you've found, because you also authored an essay with the Princess of Wales looking at that. But in terms of speaking to business leaders about what they can actually do around their employees' lives to help with that, how could that trickle down? Because we barely see an uptake, as one example, around work and family life intersecting of paternity leave.
Yes. But think about it. If you feel better about your home life while you're at work, if you feel more secure and know that you're going to have the time you need to spend with your family, you are so much better able to concentrate on your work, and you're happier at your work. And there is good science demonstrating this.
tell us more about the science then that you have found through your study and actually what we need to do to improve those connections, because what those business leaders do or don't do, you can't control.
Right, right. What we found in this 87-year-long study of the same people going through their entire lives,
which is amazing,
is that the people who lived the longest, who were happiest but also healthiest as they aged, were the people who had the best connections with other people. And the way we start building those connections is by teaching our children those social and emotional skills that then ripple all the way through adult life.
It sounds strangely obvious once you say it. And yet, what do we know about those connections and what we're not doing at the moment?
Right. Well, what we know is that really since the 1950s, we have been investing less and less in what we call social capital. We don't join clubs. We don't volunteer in communities. We don't have people to our homes as often. All of that. We don't eat together as families. And so this kind of gradual disconnection is something that's been accelerated by the digital revolution, so that we're now more isolated from each other. We spend less time on our relationships.
And or if we do join clubs, I mean, I'm generalizing here. I know there are lots of people who do volunteer in their community and do things, but typically that's the trend. That's what we're seeing. And if we do join them, maybe we join them when we've finished our working lives, almost at a different point, but we need it the whole way through, you're saying.
We need it the whole way through to keep us healthy. Literally, warmer connections prevents heart disease, prevents really? Arthritis, prevents diabetes, literally. And our lab has been unpacking how exactly that works.
Even if you're eating a lot of ultra-processed food.
Well,
just to link what we were talking about.
That's before. Important, too. Eating right, taking care of our health is hugely important, but also taking care of our relationships. And that's the thing that's often hidden in plain sight.
Do you think we can go back, though, from what phones have done to us, so that when you are with your family, you can still be thinking about that work email, you haven't quite left work, that things have become blurred in a way that they didn't used to? I always think of it like you'd be out on a social occasion, and if you suddenly looked at your phone and you get taken into a different relationship or a different moment, it's like having a letter from the past, a postal letter just thrown in your face, which wouldn't have happened by the postman or woman.
Right. And then it grabs our attention and holds us. That's what the screens are designed to do. One of my colleagues writes about what she calls continuous partial attention, that we're no longer giving each other our full attention. We're sort of half looking at our screen and half listening to the person we're with. And that is one of the most difficult things to overcome, but we can. We can learn to manage these screens.
The optimism on the program is contagious this morning. We will take it. Professor Robert Waldinger, thank you. And just to say, we're going to explore lots of these questions in our Today's Baby series in the new year, when we are going to follow three families. Thank you so much for all of your response, who are having their first baby over the first 5 years of their children's lives. Thank you.
17 minutes to nine, talking about human connection. Why do we kiss? Well, it might help to know when we... Also, we're not doing that. We're going to come back to that in a second. Forgive me. Well, that's a tease for what we're going to do about kissing in just a minute. Before that, we're going to look at a package from Jess Parker, because there are warnings that the risk surrounding Russia's shadow fleet of oil tankers is escalating. Maritime authorities are reporting a sharp spike in vessels sailing without a valid flag, which could mean they aren't insured for an accident or oil spill. Seaborne energy exports continue to generate billions for Russia as the Kremlin wages war in Ukraine. Our Europe correspondent, Jessica Parker, reports from the Baltic Sea.
This is a countdown. Aboard a British-built mine hunter on the eastern Baltic, the ship belongs to the Estonian Navy, and they're about to blow up old World War II explosives.
That bang you just heard, let me tell you what it looked like. It was a huge explosion, a gush of water. And this was a clean-up operation to do with conflicts from the past. But this stretch of water is the site of very present tensions. The Baltic is a highway for Russia's shadow fleet. Estonia keeps a watchful eye on a fleet of tankers that Moscow's accused of using to dodge Western sanctions on Russian oil after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Some are even suspected of spying or sabotage.
We have at any given time in Estonian waters anywhere between 5 and 10 vessels that are actually part of the so-called shadow fleet.
Commodore Ivo Vark is the head of the Estonian Navy.
and he's noticed something.
There is a tendency which I see is alarming, is that when we saw at the beginning of the year that there were a few vessels, you know, sanctioned vessels that actually didn't have a valid flag, it seems to be that the trend is an increasing number of vessels sailing around and having not valid flag.
The dark fleet is getting darker. Cases globally of so-called false flagging have spiked this year as sanctions intensify.
These vessels are lawless and stateless, so even if they had insurance, it would be invalidated.
Michelle Visa-Bockman is a maritime analyst at intelligence firm Windward.
If there was an accident, then good luck with trying to find, you know, somebody responsible.
How much of a threat do you think the shadow fleet is?
Many, or most, are floating rust buckets. The shadow fleet is an accident waiting to happen.
We've looked at one sanctioned tanker, Unity, that's changed flag and name several times in the last 5 years. Maritime Authority data shows it's flown the flag of the Marshall Islands. This is their national anthem. Also that of Panama, Russia, and Gambia. And one that's been listed as false, the Kingdom of Lesotho, a landlocked country in Africa. Unity was sailing east towards Russia along the Estonian coast at the same time we were out on the Baltic. We've tried emailing and calling the listed owner, which looks to be an Emirati-based firm, FMTC Ship Charter LLC. But, as you can hear, no luck. Now to the western end of the Baltic with the Swedish Coast Guard.
We are bobbing up and down in this small patrol vessel. It's a four-seater. And from here I can see the much bigger Swedish Coast Guard ship. What they're trying to do with these patrols is show a presence in these waters.
Motor tanker Tango 2, Swedish Coast Guard.
On the bridge of the main vessel, they radio a nearby sanctioned tanker. But it's then allowed to carry on towards Russia.
Thank you for your cooperation.
Would you say that the response to the Shadow Fleet is actually quite weak?
Another way to put it is that the reaction is as strong as it can be according to the rule-based order.
Coast Guard officer Matthias Lindholm.
You guys are doing a lot of watching, a lot of monitoring. That seems to be the priority.
I think you have to think at least twice before entering, let's call it a grey zone, where you are challenging the freedom of the seas.
Why?
Because the freedom of the seas is crucial for international trade.
There are also fears of Russian retaliation. Russia's embassy in London told us that it's the West's sanctions that have heightened the risks and undermined global commerce. The decades-old rules of the sea are now in rough waters.
That was Jess Parker reporting. It is 11 minutes to 9. I mentioned kissing. Why do we kiss? Well, scientists at Oxford University may have discovered that kissing evolved from our ape ancestors 21 million years ago, and there's a chance that sapiens and Neanderthals kissed each other. Dr. Matilda Brindle is lead author of the study that comes out today, an evolutionary biologist at Oxford's Department of Biology. Dr. Brindle, good morning.
Good morning.
What have you discovered?
So we have done some research into the evolution of kissing, and we have found that it probably first evolved as far back as 21.5 million years ago in the ancestor to all of the large apes.
Okay, and what's the evolutionary benefit of a little smooch?
There's various hypotheses. So some people think it could be a form of mate assessment. So if you were going to invest in mating with a partner, it makes sense to have a little bit of a kiss beforehand.
You sort of check them out.
They're healthy, you know, their breath doesn't smell, that sort of thing. The other option is that it could be to do with increasing arousal before sex, so like a form of foreplay. And that could help to increase the chance of fertilisation during subsequent copulation. So they're the kind of hypotheses for why we might kiss in a sexual sense. In terms of platonic kissing, that seems to be to do with bonding. Primates are incredibly social species, a group of species, and so it's really important for them to be able to kind of mitigate any social tensions. You know, chimpanzees will literally kiss and make up after they've had a fight. Mothers might kiss their offspring to bond with them, those sorts of things.
And is it surprising to you that sapiens and Neanderthals might have kissed each other, or is that consistent with what we knew about the relationship between those early humans?
I think that's consistent with what we knew already. So our study found that Neanderthals probably kissed. We know that humans obviously kiss each other in lots of cultures, not all of them. But what we also knew is that most humans of non-African descent do actually have a small amount of Neanderthal DNA in them. So we know that humans and Neanderthals interbred. The other thing we know is that they shared an oral microbe for a couple of hundred thousand years after the two species split, which meant that they were swapping saliva, basically. So if you take the fact that humans and Neanderthals interbred and they were swapping saliva, might have been because they were sharing food, but, you know, possibly
well,
it's because
they were kissing too. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so it looks like humans and Neanderthals kissed each other.
That is perhaps the most riveting 3 minutes of radio I've ever heard. Dr. Matilda Brindle from Oxford's Department of Biology, thank you so much.
At 8 minutes to nine, we're not kissing in the studio. Just to say, my children are totally raised on kisses, but with a two-year-old and a seven-year-old, I'm not going to buy them any skincare or face masks anytime soon, because let me tell you that face masks for four-year-olds are on sale. It's not a joke. A new product from a skincare line aimed at children by a brand called Rini. It's been launched by the US actor Shay Mitchell. You might know her from Pretty Little Liars. The products include a £6 hydrogel mask in two versions, hydrating with vitamin B12 and after sun with aloe vera. I repeat, for four-year-olds. It comes as a growing number of brands are moving into children, teenage and young adult skincare market. Well, someone who's not short of opinions and has a lot of experience, Caroline Hirons, a skincare expert, the founder of Skin Rocks, her brand, and of course, the Sunday Times best-selling author of Skincare and Teen Skincare. And also on the line, Dr. Angharad Rudkin, clinical child psychologist and author of What's My Child Thinking? Practical Child Psychology for Modern Parents. Welcome to you both. Caroline, your response to this?
Probably not words you should use this early in the morning on BBC Radio, but it's a nonsense. You know, it's a money grab. It's completely unnecessary. Young children, teenagers, I get, as soon as they have hormones, they could probably do with some skincare in the same way that they need to wash. But that's the extent of it. You know, young children and the pictures they use in the advertising their marketing team has put out there is literally of like 3 and 4 year old babies.
You champion and care greatly about the beauty industry. When you see something like this and you see a trend for it, perhaps going younger, it's by no means the norm, but
no,
it is a trend.
Yeah.
What do you say and how do you react to that in terms of the industry?
I mean, I do feel like I'm screaming at my own industry a lot of the time, but it is a very small facet of the industry. It's not, I wouldn't say it's people who really care about people's skin. It's people trying to grab money, you know, and make clickbait posts on Instagram. And it's completely unnecessary. And it does, I think it really takes away from all the good that the industry can do.
And this idea, Anghara, to bring you in, of self-care and this idea for young people, that is a key part of life, and perhaps it would come through what you put on your skin. What do you say to that around the psychology of young people?
Well, I mean, I do agree with everything that Caroline says, and I would not buy it for my own children. However, what we know about skincare, and certainly with the young people that I work with, is it's a really powerful form of self-care. So often they'll spend a lot of time doing their skin. They may have sleepovers and do face masks together. They see their parents maybe going to spas, having massages. And the rise of pamper parties for young children is just another evidence of the fact that this is something that children find quite fun.
What age, when you're saying young age, sorry, what age are you saying?
Well, I mean, four is very, very young. But, you know, six-year-olds do have pamper parties and there's mother and child or father and child spa days. So there's a real rise in this sort of sense of self-care, indulgence and pampering of oneself. And I think we have to make the distinction between that and makeup, which is a whole other set of issues in terms of accentuating certain features to make yourself more attractive.
Even though it's pampering and it could be great fun, do you not think it's the introduction of an idea of something needs to be done to you or to your face is quite a young age, the age of six?
Well, I do, but I think social media and our culture at large is more to blame for that in many ways. Mm. 4-year-olds should be completely unaware of what they look like. That's what child development tells us. A sense of looking after yourself is something that's good to instill from an early age, but a sense of looking a certain way in order to be attractive or popular is a message that we as parents in our own home need to be very, very careful to minimise and to change.
We're hearing about the culture there, Caroline, but, you know, while it's a small part of the beauty industry, what the beauty industry does on Instagram and how it has this influence, it's major, isn't it?
It is major, but I think there's an important distinction to be made between having a pamper party and being a young teen or an adolescent and the marketing that this particular brand is doing, which is a face mask on the face of a baby. I mean, essentially a baby. You would call them, a toddler. And that, to me, is the part that's deplorable. There is absolutely no need for any... I mean, one of them's an after sun. Can you imagine? Why is your 3- or 4-year-old in the sun in the first place? Why do they need after sun care? It's absolutely baffling to me and utter nonsense.
Caroline Hines, thank you for being so clear. Dr. Ang Harrod-Rookin, thank you to you. A lot of self-care in that chat. Just to say, we did talk earlier about the Today debate, which was chaired by Nick, on the question, who should pay more tax? Just to remind you, you can listen back to that whole debate on BBC Sounds Now or here on Radio 4 coming up at 11 o'clock.
The time now is 9:04. Well, there's a few members of our team who are hoping to hear 4 minutes of that, but we're not going to do that. We're going to have conversation too. We'd have loved it. We'd have both loved it, I think. But it's worth saying that that is, of course, just in case you didn't know, that is the Scottish football team's unofficial anthem, the 1970s disco classic, Yes Sir, I Can Boogie. And the reason we're playing it, just in case you haven't been listening for the last 3 hours or you were doing other things last night, is because for the first time in 3 decades, Scotland's men's football team will be at the World Cup. Let's discuss this with the comedian and Scotland fan Susie McCabe. Susie, good morning.
Good morning. How are we?
Well, I'm more interested in how are you, because it is a good morning, isn't it? Did you ever think this day would come?
No.
Well, Susie, it's been good talking to you, and that's it for me tonight. Well, no, it's a huge. I mean, was it a genuine surprise to you? Not only how amazing the match was last night, but that they've done it.
Do you know, there was a little bit of me thinking we should never have gotten that draw in Denmark. And after beating Greece at Hampden, that was also a game that I don't know how we won that game 3-1. And then we went to Greece at the weekend and it was the same old story. And then there was a little bit of me yesterday going, do you know what? There's games here that we should have lost and we didn't. And maybe tonight at Hampden, we can just do something special and be done something special. All right, you know.
You certainly have. And, you know, it's not been easy being a Scotland fan for the last few decades, has it? And, you know, in a world that seems pretty tough and sometimes a little bit difficult and grim, this is just straight up great news, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I woke up at 6:30 this morning and my first thought was, we've qualified for the World Cup. Like, we're back in the World Cup. And it just, last night, the elation, the way that game played out, Denmark had more of the ball. But do you know what my big, do you know when I got emotional was actually listening to the programme and you had Archie McPherson on.
Oh, yeah.
And
great.
When Archie's voice croaked when he said, Scotland are back at the World Cup for the first time in 28 years, I thought, I think I might cry. You know, I could feel the emotion